Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. And before we get caught up in dark conspiracies and doom and gloom scenarios, let me say to you and your families a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Hope you're all bundled up inside in your kerchief and cap and maybe a log burning on the fire, listening to your radio, getting ready to groove on some pure, unadulterated coast-to-coast AM. You know, since the late 1990s, people all over the world have been looking at the skies with a slightly different tilt from a different vantage point, mentally anyway. Since the 1950s, we've all seen what are known as contrails, that is, condensed water vapor trailing behind airplanes, coming out of the engine, exhaust. They appear when the temperature, the weather, atmospheric conditions are just right. But in the late 90s, people started seeing these weird patterns, checkerboards, and the contrails seem to linger longer, even turning into clouds, seemingly affecting our weather. So what the heck's going on? Theories abound. Speculation is rampant. Evidence? A bit sketchy. Chemtrails have been discussed on this program and in other media for several years now, but what is the evidence? Tonight we find out. Chances are you've seen these checkerboard patterns for yourself, over your communities, over your neighborhoods. A lot of listeners have already sent in photos tonight from their own chemtrail sightings. What does it mean? Who might be behind it? What is the ultimate plan or purpose? Joining me in a couple of minutes, chemtrail researcher and author William Thomas. Then a little bit later, we'll be joined by computer consultant and former defense industry scientist Clifford Carnicom, who looks at possible health effects of chemtrails. And after that, our friend Mark Allen from the Above Top Secret website, with perspective derived from interacting with his millions of followers and website visitors, should be a scintillating discussion. So I hope you got a nap tonight or today, and you can stay up late with us, put on a pot of coffee, put on some warm PJs, kick back for a bit. Time now for our first break. When we come back, William Thomas and the chemtrail mystery, where and when it all started. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Because we have three guests tonight, I skipped the normal newscast segment. With the help of our webmaster Lex, though, we did put together some items of interest on the Coast to Coast website listed there under Knapp's News, for instance. If you're interested in, maybe making $1 million, we've got some news for you about a contest to catch a Bigfoot. Well, that's all you have to do, huh? Capture Bigfoot. $1 million. Sounds simple enough. We've got the story. Also, some additional items about that discovery of the super Earth planet about 40 light years from here. That's practically right in the neighborhood. Looks like it's a water planet, which raises the obvious question of whether there is life there. And there's another item which examines speculation that billionaire and famed aviator Howard Hughes was invited to see the Roswell wreckage back at the time when the crash occurred. It's a fun read. Check it out when you get a chance. Joining me now is William Thomas, author of five books, including one called Chemtrails Confirmed. Mr. Thomas, glad you're here.
Pleasure to be with you, George, and our listening audience.
Great. We hear a lot on this program about skeptics and skepticism, and in the context of Coast to Coast, skepticism has sort of earned a bad name, deservedly so, because the kind of skepticism we encounter in discussing paranormal topics, UFOs, things like that, is more akin to debunking than the traditional definition of skepticism. The true skeptic is like the guy from Missouri who says, show me, meaning I don't necessarily believe it, but I'm ready to be convinced, assuming you have evidence. You know, the new skeptics are more like debunkers. You couldn't get them to change their minds no matter what evidence might be presented. I mentioned this at the start because I'm a skeptic about chemtrails. I've looked at the subject for TV reports. I'm intrigued by it. It makes me scratch my head, but I'm unconvinced so far. So convince me. Give me the thumbnail sketch about what's going on, when it started, and why.
Well, of course, the whole chemtrails issue started quite a while ago. We can actually go all the way back to the Hopi prophecies I was looking at that tonight before the show, and of course the Hopis were the ones who said, and they were so right about many things, from railroads to the eagle has landed on the moon, and they also said, when cobwebs appear in the sky, the day of purification is near. I thought that was very compelling, and of course that's an ancient prophecy. More recently, and as far back as 1965, we see the first geoengineering report calling for something like chemtrails landing on President Johnson's desk. And that report said that if CO2 in the atmosphere doubles, as it was expected to, and somehow just under 2% of sunlight is blocked and reflected back into space, we're back to our original climate. The National Academy of Science followed up on that in the 70s and 90s with three major studies calling for atmospheric sunscreens using sunlight-reflecting chemicals. They said airplanes, tanker planes, flying just 500 miles, about an hour and a half's flight, could see these sunlight-reflecting chemicals in the stratosphere for a delivery cost of about $500 per ton.
Well, let's back up for a second. This first report that landed on President Johnson's desk, who wrote that?
Oh, boy. I don't have the author of the report. But
what I mean, somebody like NASA or an agency or something like that?
It was a person involved with climate modification. I could look it up during the break. The point was that Johnson jumped on that report not for chemtrails, but for something called Operation Popeye, backed by the United States Air Force, which seeded the Ho Chi Minh Trail, you might recall, with silver iodide to enhance and intensify the monsoons and try to drown out that supply route. It failed to do that, and Congress got in an uproar when they found this out because, of course, the practice of climate modification was and remains illegal.
Illegal under what? International law?
Under the United Nations NMOD treaty, saying that any climate modification, large-scale weather modification, using any means, is illegal. That treaty was signed by the United States.
So you would say that if, in fact, this thing started, it started for ostensibly somewhat beneficial purposes, to protect the planet from a changing atmosphere, to win a war, something like that?
Ostensibly, yes. The idea was to originally to block sunlight and ameliorate global warming. But interestingly, George, that report on President Johnson's desk never once mentioned cutting back on carbon emissions and pollution. It went right for the quick fix, and that's where we find ourselves today.
Tell me about the rest of the paper trail. Is there something of a more recent vintage that suggests that it was actually implemented?
Yeah, we have some serious paper in 1994. People can find this online. The patent issued to the Hughes Aircraft Company, I heard his name mentioned a few minutes ago. This time, this patent was for the Welsbach seeding for the reduction of global warming. Welsbach particles supposedly change the heat trapped near the Earth's surface into infrared wavelengths and radiate it back into space. More commonly, these particles of highly reflective aluminum oxide, in particular quartz and barium as well, seated in the upper atmosphere, also reflect sunlight. And it was the late Dr. Edward Teller, whose computer modeling done by Ken Caldera, who I talked to, by the way, showed that if 10 million tons of these very small particulates, we're talking 10 microns, according to the patent, one-tenth the diameter of a human hair. 10 million tons of this stuff spread in the upper atmosphere, Teller said, would reflect enough sunlight to halt global warming, even as CO2 levels doubled. That is, would reflect about 1% of incoming sunlight.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far off on the global warming discussion, but I do want to get this out of the way before we go too much further. Where are you on that? Because you're talking about documents presented to President Johnson talking about global warming.
Yes.
But as you know, there's quite a bit of controversy about whether it's real and what the causes are, even today.
Well, with respect, I would suggest that the polar bears in the north, far north, and the penguins in the far south have no controversy about this whatsoever, nor the Greenland ice. Something's going on that's major. And, of course, people assert all kinds of things, and we don't want to get sidetracked, as you say. Again, the point is that regardless of these so-called controversies, the original purpose behind so-called chemtrails or sunscreens was to ameliorate global warming, which was seen as a problem in the late 60s and cited as a planetary emergency by Teller at an international conference in 1998. And at that conference, he called for these so-called scatterers to be placed in the upper atmosphere as a sunscreen.
And is it your guess that that is what is going on now, or that it's evolved into something else?
Well, I think we can do a touch better than a guess. We have a source that was heard on Coast to Coast some years ago now called Deep Sky. He's an air traffic control manager for the entire northeastern seaboard of the United States, an FAA government employee. And in March 2001, he was interviewed three times by a radio journalist named S.T. Brent. I also submitted questions for those interviews, two of them before witnesses. And he said on tape, for the record, that air traffic controllers across the United States were being ordered, and still are, by the way, to divert incoming commercial flights lower and away from United States Air Force tankers spraying a substance that reflected and obscured air traffic control radars. And he further said, when she asked, well, what was the purpose of this? And he said in the first interview that they were being told weather modification. And in the last interview, he said that had been changed to climate modification was the official explanation to air traffic controllers.
Doesn't seem to be working, does it?
I'm not sure that it's working at all. However, we know that contrails, the normal condensation trails you referred to off the top of the show, do seem to be having quite an effect on weather and temperature. We know that from NASA studies showing a change in temperature range of just over 1 degree centigrade. Well, maybe that's 1.2 or so degrees Fahrenheit. From a climate perspective, that's huge. And this is attributed to normal condensation trails in heavy flight corridors like over the Atlantic Ocean, Midwestern United States, Northwestern United States, Central Europe, and they're showing a major drop in sunlight and temperature. In fact, scientists have come up with a term called global dimming, referring to a drastic decrease in sunlight in very recent decades, particularly over the United States, Britain, Central Europe, Soviet Union, and the scientists say that the pollution that factor into this cannot account for this drastic global dimming.
You know, I'm standing on the ground. I'm looking up. The planes are flying in and out and over McCarran Airport here in Las Vegas, and I'm seeing these contrails and the checkerboard patterns. Is there a way to be on the ground and tell the difference between chemtrail and contrail, or does that take another kind of analysis?
No, it's a very good way to discover what's happening. In fact, we have Mark Stedham in Houston, Texas, in the winter of, I think that was 02. And he did a study doing just what you're suggesting. He stood on the ground near the Houston Airport, International Airport, in the winter of 2000, I'll correct myself. And he checked out heavy aircraft overflying the area. And he used a program available to anyone called Flight Explorer. And this is an FAA subscription flight data service that identifies and tracks all aircraft on instrument flight plans, that's all your commercial and military traffic, overflying the U.S., and it identifies them by the type of aircraft, location, altitude, heading, and airspeed. It does not identify U.S. military planes, simply gives them an unidentified label, which in a sense, does identify them. So for 4 months, he did what you're suggesting, stood out there, looked at the aircraft trails in the sky, timed them, and went to Flight Explorer for the identification, and the results were remarkable. He said in his report, and it's in my new book, Chemtrails Confirmed 2010, 96% of the contrails he observed lasted only 5 to 20 seconds, 80% 30 seconds or less. One airliner contrail did last for 25 minutes and another for 5 hours, and they were exceptions. Now, here's the catch, George. In the same airspace, in the same time, the same atmospheric conditions, military aircraft left trails lasting not 10 to 20 seconds, but 4 to 8 hours. So he knew right then that, in fact, there was a huge difference between the trails laid down by commercial airliners, the contrails you mentioned earlier, and chemtrails.
And is it possible that that's a difference of altitude, that the military guys were flying at a different altitude?
They would be flying higher in colder air, and they should be leaving slightly more persistent contrails. That is absolutely correct, but certainly not 5 to 8 hours, and not a difference of that time span in 10 to 20 seconds between themselves and commercial airliners, maybe 2,000 or 1,000 feet lower. We're talking a temperature gradient of 3 degrees less per 1,000 feet, so that doesn't track. What does track are calculations made in Boulder, Colorado, by the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they've looked at this, and they said, look, the only way you can form a contrail behind an aircraft in atmospheric conditions of humidity less than 70% and temperatures warmer than minus 76 degrees, in other words, the only way you can do this if the air is not super cold and super moist is to add particulates to the atmosphere, and the smaller the size of each of these added nuclei, the greater the rate of artificial cirrus cloud formation.
I was going to say, I've seen this, I've watched it myself, in that these trails settle down, disperse, and they become clouds, and they stick around a long time.
They do, especially over major air routes. But we have to make a distinction here. We're not talking contrails lasting for many hours in a usual circumstance, as the government likes to claim, as officials like to claim. We are talking about artificial cirrus clouds formed around the exhaust particles and moisture of high-flying jet airliners. So these become actual cirrus clouds caused by these particles.
Are you saying that the trails, the contrails from planes that we see all the time, don't become clouds like that, or do they?
Only rarely, and only in major air traffic centers like the Atlantic and parts of the United States. But generally speaking, and NASA on their own website says contrails last 30 seconds. That's NASA's deal. And NASA goes even further, and this I find compelling. Their scientists look very hard at contrails because of the weather and temperature changes associated with them. The U.S. military, of course, is very concerned. They don't want to draw a big white arrow to one of their stealth aircraft flying at altitude. So they're both very concerned with decreasing contrails. The airlines don't want to get fined or face restrictions in flight because of their contrails. So they looked hard at this. And NASA came up with a surprising finding. And this goes right to the heart of the controversy because, you know, the most common excuse given by government officials is, oh, you're just seeing normal contrails, but you're seeing more of them, many more of them, because of increased air traffic. And air traffic has certainly increased since the jet age really took off in the late 70s, early 80s. But in November 01, NASA came out and said, we've looked at this and we are finding that contrails are actually decreasing because of radical, unexplained atmospheric changes. But the contrails are decreasing even over places like the Pacific Northwest.
Well, I wonder if November of 01 you saw a decrease because it was 2 months after 9/11 attacks and people weren't flying very much.
They factored that in, and their study had started well before the 9/11 attacks, And so they said, no, that was not the cause. They said that despite increased air traffic over time, contrails, normal contrails, were decreasing. And, you know, that was big news to people I was in touch with in the Seattle, Portland area. I'm here on the northwest coast of Canada. And they were reporting all kinds of health problems from major gritting and X's and these parallel rows of plumes over their heads.
Hey, William, we're going to get into that. We need to take a break right now. William Thomas, author of Chemtrails Confirmed, is our guest, and we've got others going to be joining us soon. Led Zepp, Kashmir, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. William Thomas is my guest. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. He is the author of Chemtrails Confirmed and four other books. William, let's go back to this idea of a paper trail. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that there were papers talking about weather modification, things of that sort, dating back to the 60s. Have you picked it up since then? Is there a piece of paper that says, put this order into effect, we're going to spray this stuff all over the planet? Is it, and if so, were you able to acquire this like through FOIA or something of that sort?
I have two things for you, George. The first, I actually has referenced my own book during the break. That memo I earlier referred to President Johnson was a secret 1967 memo, and you were right, military memo from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they were requesting authorization to, quote, implement operational phase of weather modification process, and catch this, previously successfully tested and evaluated in some areas. And this revelation came from a U.S. Senate subcommittee report in July 72. So there you go. That's one major paper trail, if you like. We also have, of course, as I mentioned, the Hughes aircraft patent, and we have lab tests coinciding with that patent. We'll get into those in a second. But of course, it's the Welsbach patent and the U.S. Air Force owning the weather 2025 that are the big smoking guns, if you like, in terms of paper.
All right, Air Force 2025. Tell me about that, because okay. I've seen references to it.
Well, that's an Air Force study put out saying that, of course, we're just this is a blue sky kind of speculation, they said, when in fact it was nothing of the kind. That report talked about weather force specialists flying tanker planes to enable something they called aerial obscuration by spraying out chemicals behind the aircraft to occlude the sky and to change and manipulate weather for military purposes. They actually called it a capability of producing desired weather behavior. Now, remember, this came out in 1995, and we're way down the weather modification road since that was first released.
But, I mean, is that sort of a wishful thinking kind of a thing on the part of the Air Force? Hey, by 2025, we'd like to have this capability. Can you give us the money for it? Or are they just sort of wargaming, speculating about what the future might hold? Or is it something more solid than that?
I think it was more of a trial balloon. The military and other agencies have a habit of leaking a portion of their not only research, but actual capabilities ahead of time to acclimate people, if you will, to these new technologies. And while the Air Force claims exactly what you're stating, that this was purely speculative, in fact, the Air Force has been very much involved in weather control since the late 1940s. And we have, of course, Operation Storm Fury during the 60s, which was directed at modifying and changing the tracks of hurricanes. So the Air Force is really heavily invested, in the literal sense of the word, in weather modification. We also have, of course, their Vision 2020, which calls for full-spectrum dominance over land, sea, ocean, and undersea, all over the Earth. And that is a major thrust of the Pentagon, of the U.S. military, and that involves as well weather modification. Finally, we know this, and this is a big piece of paper, if you will. H.R. 2977, that's a bill presented, you might recall, by Ohio Representative Dennis Kucinich back in October 2001. And this rocked the chemtrails community as well as Congress, because his Space Preservation Act called for the use, peaceful uses of space and a ban on exotic weapons. And in Section 7 of his bill, he specifically sought to prohibit chemtrails. He used that word, chemtrails. And in interviews subsequent to that, he said, Kucinich said that as the head of the Armed Force Armed Services Oversight Committee, he was well acquainted with chemtrail projects. And I was told by people in Santa Fe Santa Cruz, California, that when Kucinich was campaigning for the presidency down there, he was asked about chemtrails at a public meeting, and his reply was, chemtrails are real. So he actually put a bill forward seeking to ban chemtrails.
I really like Congressman Kucinich on a lot of levels, yeah. I guess, but you know, you have to take some of it with a grain of salt. Certainly none of his colleagues have confirmed any of this stuff, and we don't have a way to confirm that either. I mean, he's talking about something he's learned in a classified briefing, right?
Well, I think we have a somewhat of a confirmation in that the bill caused such an uproar, particularly the chemtrails segment, that it was withdrawn from Congress, and a substitute bill was put forward that eliminated all references not only to chemtrails, but to HAARP and similar weather modification weapons. So he got a reaction, a serious reaction to his bill.
Have you tried using a FOIA to see if you can find a smoking gun document?
You know what? I really have not done that, because I'm convinced that given the executive orders around FOIAs and given the stonewalling I've seen as a journalist put forward to people who have requested FOIAs, and of course they get reams of very expensive, by the way. It's very costly to pay for these documents. That's part of the stonewalling.
And you're a journalist. See, you can get the journalist discount. You can.
I can get the journalist discount, but I'm an independent journalist budget, right?
I'll help you out.
Thank you. But these things, if we did this, we would find documents that would be almost completely redacted, I'm quite certain. So, no, I haven't gone the FOIA route, but I do tend to gravitate toward federal aviation employees who speak on the record, people like Dennis Kucinich, who puts bills forward, and actual radar-confirmed sightings of chemtrails and the remarks by air traffic controllers at that time tied to specific lab tests.
I want to come back to the air controllers in a second and the whole idea of whistleblowers. Before we leave this paper trail idea, though, you've recently had a change of administrations a year ago, and Obama and Bush see the world much differently. Can you see that program continuing then, that both of these presidents would be aware of it and okay it, or are you saying that the presidents don't necessarily have to know?
Well, that's a great question, because, of course, the program is continuing, and Obama is fully behind chemtrails. In fact, his science advisor, John Holdren, came very close to outing chemtrails in his very first interview after that administration took office. Sorry, we're talking April in 2009, April 18th, and science advisor Holdren said, global warming is so dire, the Obama administration is discussing radical technologies to cool Earth's air. That's a quote from the actual press conference. He said that the administration was considering these last resort technologies to cool off the global greenhouse, including, he said, spreading a sunlight-reflecting artificial cloud cover. Said it's got to be looked at. We don't have the luxury of taking any approach off the table. So, boy, they are fully on board with chemtrails.
Wow. So why not, if it's happening and if it's something that's absolutely necessary, why not come forward and make the case to the public and admit it? It's going on. Is it still illegal?
Well, it's certainly illegal under NMOD. It's certainly illegal under FAA regulations about putting pollutants deliberately into the air. I think more to the point, however, is that governments, and I'm talking all governments here, do not like to admit anything at all. That's kind of the golden rule in governance. You don't admit things, especially you don't admit programs that have been going on for, well, we're coming up on my 11th anniversary here of breaking this story on Coast to Coast. in January 99. So you've got at least an 11-year program. If you come out now and admit it as the White House administration, you're going to have to explain why this has been going on and you haven't admitted it. You're also going to have to explain why a planetary emergency, a climate emergency, is so dire as to need this program when the administration is saying, well, yeah, it's climate change is a problem, but it's no big deal, and it can be handled. We can adapt and cope with it. So suddenly you're saying, no, actually, it's a dire emergency, so serious that we have to spread chemicals in the air that are going to make a lot of people very sick.
Wouldn't the other nations of the world have to be in on this, not just us doing it, but they'd have to know? And you would think that some of them would pitch a fit about it, especially developing nations opposed to any kind of controls or interference on the issue of global warming or climate change.
It appears that the nations involved with this, and we're talking quite a few, I enumerate them based on actual sightings in my book, they're all allied nations, allied to the United States, and so they are militarily in alignment. We know from Deep Sky, our air traffic controller on the U.S. Northeast Coast, that he said that looking at his own radars, these Air Force tankers, U.S. Air Force, I should emphasize, were flying, continuing to fly north into Canada, spreading those trails that were picked up on radar. And, of course, we have other confirmations we'll get into in a bit on those planes over Canada. So the Canadian government, for one, is fully on board with this climate mitigation measure. And why wouldn't a government come on board if climate change is real, or if it even is a potential dire threat? What government would not go for the quick fix instead of biting a much harder bullet by having its populace, say, drive less and pollute less? I think that's a no-brainer for most governments.
Let's talk about whistleblowers. Now, you mentioned Deep Sky, and this guy sounds like, I understand the need for confidential sources. I'm a journalist. I rely on confidential sources all the time. But you also recognize the value of having someone come forward, their name, their face, they speak on the record. Where's the whistleblower in the chemtrail story? Somebody who comes forward and says, I worked in this program. I put this stuff on the planes. I installed the nozzles. I was part of it. I commanded a whole bunch of tankers, somebody like that.
Boy, you know, we've got these folks coming forward anecdotally. We have these emails, and we've had them for years from a purported, and I say purported, mechanic on an airline saying he fitted tanks to airliners. We have people saying, yeah, I was a tanker pilot, and we sprayed these chemicals. And I've talked to some of these weather modification pilots, and as a former pilot myself, I can tell by their jargon and their manner when they're genuine. And I'm convinced that I've talked to genuine Air Force people involved in this and similar programs, but none of them, not one, would volunteer their names or even send me any proof of their, say, their unit. I said, well, just send me a cap, you know, a souvenir cap from your squadron. That's easy. You hand them out to everybody. No, they wouldn't even go that far. People involved in the military, and I've been a member of the military, are understandably very concerned, even frightened, of breaking national security around this issue, because the penalties can be drastic. First of all, they would be considered traitors by their fellow military personnel. And secondly, they could end up in a military prison, which is not very nice, much worse than a civilian prison. Even their families could be threatened. So, yes, in answer to your question, we're still waiting. You know, I get remarks, this one from the Alpenhorn News in December 2005. Yeah, we have them, but we're not supposed to talk about it. This is an Air Force pilot confirming the chemtrails. I've got just above it in the book a picture of a spray apparatus coming out the tail of a KC-10 refueling tanker, quite different from the normal refueling nozzles that I put next to it. So we have that, but I'm afraid that we may never get at least an active service member coming forward or anyone else involved in this program that will actually give us their identification for print.
Well, as you know, we cover the UFO topic a lot on this,
yes.
And that's another big conspiracy where potential military witnesses and whistleblowers have been threatened, their lives threatened, their families threatened, they've been threatened with going to prison, and yet a lot of those guys have come forward. So there is a difference there, and I'm sure it raises a red flag for people who are listening to you make the case when you have to say that all your sources so far are confidential, right?
Well, I guess so. I don't know. UFOs are considered, quote, so fringe that, and I've seen some of these people coming forward on video, very compelling radar evidence, as you're well aware, and eyewitness reports, and yet going back many decades, and I guess they're just not considered a threat, whereas this is an ongoing program of the gravest and greatest national priority, and to break into an ongoing program like that, I think, could carry far more dire consequences. It is frustrating. I do admit that. We have two Lawrence Livermore scientists interviewed by a friend of mine, Bob Fitrakis. He's an award-winning reporter for the Columbus Alive magazine. And in December 01, he interviewed them, and they were on loan to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, he checked them out and found they were genuine, but he, too, could not reveal their names. But those scientists talked about two different secret projects being conducted. One involved cloud creation, they said, to lessen the effects of global warming. The other involved spreading these reflectant clouds to bounce off HARP beams, the transmitter up in Gakona, Alaska, for weather modification, communications disruption, and 3D mapping. And they said further that when you see the planes flying back and forth in parallel lines and those X patterns, that's aluminum oxide being spread. Otherwise, they spray aluminum oxide and barium to bounce radar and radio beams over the horizon, such as used to fly drones in Afghanistan.
Let me be the devil's advocate for a second here. You're talking about two scientists on loan from Los Alamos to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base speaking off the record to a reporter about these programs. Those guys are not hard to track down if that's, in fact, where they worked. How many Los Alamos scientists are on loan to Wright-Patterson? I'm just saying, yeah. These guys have blown it. If they really are who they say they are, they've blown it because somebody's figured out who they are by now.
Well, actually, they're from Lawrence Livermore, and I called up Ken Caldera. You recall I mentioned that he had done the computer simulations for this project for Teller, and he was hoping the computer would prove them wrong. He said, this is a very dangerous idea, spraying these reflectant chemicals in the upper atmosphere, because they tend to cool off the upper atmosphere, drastically cool it, and this forms ice crystal clouds that attract and accumulate CFCs, and he said chemtrails, he didn't use that word, but these reflectant chemicals would actually, and these are his words, destroy the ozone layer. So he was very unhappy to find out that the computer simulation said, well, this will work. So I called him up and I said, you're at Lawrence Livermore. What about these scientists at Wright-Patterson? And he said he was not aware of any chemtrails project, and he was not aware of those scientists. So either Bob Fitrakis was talking to ghosts, and he's a very good reporter, or Mr. Caldera was simply out of the loop.
Or these guys were feeding him a line of bull.
Well, we've corroborated it so many ways. We have the lab tests. We have the people on radar. We have the FAA officials. In fact, we have air traffic controllers around the United States confirming this.
Well, I mean, sort of in the way of disinformation, the kind of stuff we run into in the UFO field. They were feeding him some stuff with bits and pieces and kernels of truth, but leading him in a direction. And I'm just being devil's advocate
again.
I
welcome that, and that's totally fair, and I appreciate your respect at the same time. We do know that there is a U.S. Navy and concurrent military programs involving spraying barium for 3D mapping. That can be found on the Internet. So the programs referred to by these, yes, anonymous scientists are real, and at least the 3D mapping, the barium program, can be discovered. And as Cliff Carnegie will tell you later on, he was the first to find out that barium levels have increased drastically in the water and soil samples across the United States.
All right, we're going to get into that in our next segment, talking with William Thomas, author of Chemtrails Confirmed. Coming up, Cliff Carnicom will join us as well to talk about some chemical analysis. And I want to get into the idea of whether this could be done without active participation. Maybe you could do it just by adding something to jet fuel and people wouldn't have to know about it. And we also want to get into the potential health effects of spraying stuff like this up in the air. Stay with us, a lot more to come on Coast to Coast AM. We've been talking with William Thomas, author of Chemtrails Confirmed. Coming up later in the program, Mark Allen from Above Top Secret will join us. And in just a couple of minutes, Clifford Carnicom will also be here to discuss his research. William, before we bring on Cliff, I wanted to ask you about the other kinds of dark motives that have been discussed as possible reasons for spraying stuff in the sky. Diseases, population control, New World Order, that kind of stuff. Do you go that far?
I don't go that far in a sense of deliberate activities to deliberately cull the population. However, I will go further down the road than I used to after talking with my source. I've worked with this gentleman for some 15 years now. We've broken some major stories together. He was even on Coast to Coast under the pseudonym Hank. And he has looked into this and talked to people involved with this program, even from other countries. And he recently told me that, yes, in fact, other programs were being piggybacked on the Chemtrails Climate Modification Project. In particular, he said that on some occasions, perhaps one in 100 flights, biowarfare simulants were being added and are being added to chemtrails to make people sick enough to report to hospitals and doctors so that military researchers can track the dispersal patterns of these germs. Now, I've written extensively on biowarfare. I wrote a book called Bringing the War Home on the undeclared biowarfare in the Gulf during Desert Storm. I was over there myself and got very sick for my experience with an environmental emergency response team. I learned in my research and said in the book that spreading biowarfare material at high altitudes is counterproductive. These materials are killed off by strong ultraviolet radiation at altitude. They fall to Earth in a very dispersed, diluted pattern and are further degraded by more sunlight and rain. The Iraqi military spread biological chemical agents over American and allied troops at a place called Al Jubail, which I visited in Saudi Arabia after the fact, at very low altitudes to keep the concentrations. And in fact, they made a lot of soldiers, as we later learned, very ill indeed. Well, these new high-altitude chemtrail biowarfare experiments are apparently encapsulating these biowarfare simulants in polymers to protect them from degradation until they can be released automatically at ground level. So I'm very concerned at this because my source said the purpose behind this program is to test the possibility of infecting entire regions, and he said entire nations, with biowarfare materials. And I find this reprehensible and extremely disturbing. Again, this isn't actually being done on a biowarfare level. It is being done on a simulant level. It is making people sick, and the implications are very disturbing.
All right, we're going to jump in and get into the evidence of who's being made sick, how many, and what kind of sickness after this break. William Thomas, stay with us. Cliff Carnicom is going to be joining us in a moment right after this. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We've been talking with William Thomas about chemtrails, joined now by Clifford Carnicom, who, according to your according to your bio that you sent to us, had done some work with a top secret clearance for the military or associated with military programs. What was that about?
Good evening, George, and thanks very much for the chance
sure.
to be here tonight. I worked for the Defense Mapping Agency Aerospace Center, now under a different name, under the intelligence agencies now. But this is the branch of the Air Force on a civilian level that is responsible for preparation of the, what's called cartographic and geodetic products for the military.
How'd you get hooked on this?
My work is pretty strong in the technical fields, and I became a land surveyor at a portion of my career, and an extension of the land surveying field is what's called geodesy. And geodesy is a rather comprehensive science involving quite a bit of geophysical and mathematical disciplines. And I had the, I suppose, the initiative and the desire to pursue that at a career level, and was fortunate enough to be given that opportunity.
I don't know if you were able to listen to much of our interview with William Thomas.
I have been able to, George, and I thank you for that.
Tell me about, let's talk about sources. Do you have whistleblowers? Do you have your own range of sources that come forward with bits and pieces of information?
Pretty much I can say unequivocally, absolutely not. If I had any direct information, I would make that available. Most everything I do is public out of necessity. My work is conducted as an independent researcher and an independent party, not out of desire. So certainly there are, let's call them, some interesting hearsay statements that have evolved over the years. If it's quite unusual, I may put that up, although it's very rare. I probably have over maybe 2 to 3 of those over a 10-year period. And they, from my standpoint, would be simply that they are to be regarded as hearsay. But sometimes hearsay is a viable form of evidence, but that's certainly not at all any type of dominant component of my work. My work is primarily original independent research based on the ground where I live.
Well, give me your take on it. What's going on? How big it is? What's the ultimate purpose? And do you diverge from what William's theories are?
In terms of what's going on, I think that the evidence and information that at least I have been able to assess and compile over the years indicates a very broad-scoped program involving numerous aspects, each one of great complexity. And I'll come up with the list for you in just a minute. It'll be 7 items. I call them application endeavors, areas of application. There's absolutely nothing that would say positively any single one of these is, let's say, acknowledged in any way. But if I and do list the 7 for you, the reason I list that 7 is because all of the information is, let's say, compatible and commensurate let's say, satisfies each one of those applications as being consistent with all of the others. It doesn't mean that they're all occurring. It doesn't mean that any of them are occurring. But it wouldn't be in the list unless it satisfied all the data. And that list is as follows. The first of those, and this is only 1 of 7, is what I would call environmental modification and control. Weather modification would be one branch or division of that. I do not, let's say, dismiss the importance or relevance of that subject, but by no means would I consider it to be the, let's say, comprehensive intent of these operations. The second would be that of military operations. The third would be that of electromagnetic operations. The fourth would be biological operations. The fifth was a little bit more esoteric at the beginning, but, you know, as it was studied, really became less so. And that is actual consideration of planetary and global modification and or scope. Literally affecting, let's call it, the dynamics of the planet. Again, I'm not saying it's dominant. I'm not saying it's even the case, but I'm saying the data is consistent with that. The next to last one would be that of the development of a rather advanced surveillance system. This is a little bit more on a conceptual level also, but does appear to be quite feasible and consistent. And the last one, probably the most remote of them, but still to be fairly considered, and that is the use of these materials to detect what I'd call exotic propulsion systems. Common language, of course, is UFO, but in terms of technically what I would actually anticipate or expect, it would be detection of disturbances of a plasma or ionic nature. So this is, to me, what represents at least the result of my work in terms of the scope and comprehensiveness of this operation and weather modification or environmental control would certainly be one. But, you know, the truth is we could take any one of those or all of those and have quite extended discussions on each of them.
Well, tell me this. I mean, you make the list. Do you think all of them are taking place? What's your gut? Or do
the gut is that they are all consistent. In other words, they are all consistent with the data. You know, you'll notice in my work, I don't try to extrapolate beyond that, which I think can be documented. You made a comment about Missouri. You know, that's okay with me. I lived in Missouri for 7 years, and I'm okay with that because I think that we need to have the best information available. I have limitations on what I have access to, what I'm able to do, my particular talents and resources, but certainly I am obligated and have a responsibility to use those to the best of my ability. And the statement is that all of these operations are consistent with all of the data that has been accumulated or presented through my perspective over the years. And if any one of them was not consistent, I wouldn't be saying it. I will say that there is a body of evidence for each one of these that supports. And in most cases, sometimes it would be pure analysis, like when you get into a surveillance system or something like that. Sometimes it's by sheer analysis. But, you know, analysis is a viable approach also. But in most cases, the majority of my work is based upon actual observation, sampling, or analysis to the best of my ability with the limited resources that I have. So there's a great deal of observational and actual hands-on work that is to be discussed at some point if we want to evaluate that evidence.
I want to ask both of you this question in terms of explanations that have been offered. I know that Discovery Channel did a show. There have been statements from NASA dismissing this. There have been a variety of statements from officials saying it's all a bunch of tinfoil hat kind of paranoia. Discuss that. William, we'll start with you. Discuss the official response to questions raised by people like you and the quality of the evidence and argumentation.
Well, I think, that, again, the most common argument put forward by officialdom is that these are normal contrails spread by an increase in air traffic, and we've already discussed how NASA itself has disputed that, saying actual condensation trails from aircraft are decreasing despite the increased air traffic. So that really doesn't fly. As far as the tinfoil hat brigade, in my book, I list quite a number of military pilots, police officers, and other people like that, trained professionals, trained in observation, who have come forward with their names and said, we are seeing some very strange things relating to these trails in the sky, relating to cobwebs draped over the Denver airport in one case, the police officer's own uniform in another case. These people have come forward. I would not denigrate them with the tin hat appellation. They're very respectable observers, and there's quite a lot of them. And finally, I would say, and this is what got me going on the story, George, I was originally assigned to this by Environment News Service back in the winter of 98, and the editor there, Jim Crabtree, called me up and said, would you check out a videotape by some guy named William Wallace in Washington State? He's living up there in the mountains very remotely with his wife, and he says these planes are flying back and forth, spreading these trails. So he sent me the tape, and I watched it, and I started laughing. I have to admit, I said, come on, these are contrails. You know, what's going on here? I'm a former pilot, an ocean sailor. And I tell you, after about 20 minutes, I stopped laughing because those trails lingered and spread out and covered the whole sky, and I knew those are not normal contrails that I was watching. And so as I began following up eyewitness accounts and being led from person to person across the entire United States until I had literally hundreds of written evidence from these people describing what they were seeing, I realized, George, that, you know, as you said at the top of the show, people, we've been looking at contrails for our entire lives. Nobody really looks at them twice. And yet, why were hundreds, even thousands of people in the United States, Europe, and Canada stopping their cars, pulling off the highway, pulling their families and friends out of their homes, and dragging them outside and pointing to the sky and saying, look at that. Have you ever seen anything like that? Shooting miles of videotape, thousands of photographs of contrails? No, this was something very unusual that no one had ever seen before.
Clifford, you must get a lot of emails and letters from pilots. I imagine a lot of those would say, it's a bunch of baloney. I'm a pilot. I've been flying for years. This is a bunch of baloney. I don't know anything about it.
That's true. There's a segment of responses that are of that character and that nature. So much now. For many years, that type of response was more characterized earlier in the research, I would say. At this point, people are pretty familiar with my research and the nature of it, and that type of statement doesn't really mean a whole lot unless we have, again, the type of support or documentation that would actually substantiate the statement. And in general, character statements or statements that are just opinions, they really don't have too much weight in the actual final analysis.
I think probably what we need is some sort of smoking gun chemical analysis. You get in a plane, you go behind one of these other these tankers or jetliners that are spraying this stuff out, you take a sample up in the air, and then you analyze it. Has that been done? Can it be done? Starting with you, Cliff, and then, Will, you can jump into that as well.
Well, the question is, has it been done? No. Has there been any presentation of any information at the appropriate level of documentation for that type of testing? No. If I was conducting that type of test, I think I would offer a much simpler arrangement. I think it would actually be, let's call it a misuse of resources to schedule any single test. The very first thing I would do, which would be quite simple, I believe, is simply extract every single HEPA filter that's flying from every aircraft across this country, where you would be talking about hundreds of thousands of these filtration devices, and have those filters analyzed properly. Be a much simpler and more cost-effective means of getting an actual, more accurate representation.
Oh, good idea.
Of any chemical constitutional changes that have taken place. I do think the idea of spending a lot of money to put up a single plane and collect a single sample is very weak, a very weak approach in terms of actually providing meaningful or useful information. So that's one idea that could be considered that, to my knowledge, has never even been slightly approached.
And is that a matter of cost, or you don't have the authority, or what?
Oh, I would those and more. You could take any one of those. We have some. You know, this is certainly a question that comes up. That, you know, the common question is, why the heck don't you just do this? Just get the plane and go do this. Well, if you actually start examining the logistics of that, I'm sorry, we have some problems, okay? Certainly a cost issue is one. Number two would be access, okay? That's a controlled flight environment at that altitude. Everything that's up there is known positively, so it would have to be authorized. And unfortunately, I think I have to put forth the conclusion that these operations are of a covert nature. And there is a lot of consequences that are expected from that in terms of access of information.
I would imagine, too, since it's not every, you're not saying every plane flying up there is spraying this stuff. So you get a plane, you go to the trouble of renting the plane and the equipment, you fly behind another plane, and you don't know which one's spraying and which one isn't. So chances of getting a negative are pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, the obvious and simple thing to do is simply start. There's certainly you could run tests to no end, but start by collecting every HEPA filter on every aircraft flying at that altitude, 30 to 40,000 feet, and analyze them properly.
Will, very quickly, any thoughts of your own on the chemical analysis?
I agree completely with Clifford, and I think that's an excellent suggestion regarding the air filters. Of course, airliner cabin air is called bleed air. It comes in right through the engines and is taken off, of course, before it's burned and diverted into the cabin. So it would be a true test of the chemical constituents at altitude. Of course, as he mentioned, instrument flight rules at altitude, you're not going to get anywhere near another heavy aircraft simply by laws and regulations. First of all, and secondly, when I looked into it, the charter rate for an aircraft big enough and fast enough to get up there was $10,000 a day.
All right. Well, we're taking another break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, get into it with Cliff a little bit about possible health effects, in particular Morgellons disease, and then later We'll be joined by Mark Allen of AboveTopSecret.com. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Cliff Carnicum and William Thomas here to talk about chemtrails. I tell you that the possibility that something's being sprayed up there to spread disease, to kill people, population control, new world order. You've been hearing that. We've been hearing that since the beginning of the chemtrail controversy 10 years ago or so. And I remember the first time that I dug into this for a TV series that I produced. You know, you go out and talk to people who are sitting on their porch. They say, we saw these trails, flying over our homes. And then a couple days later, we got sick, and they draw a connection. And I thought it was always sort of weak because, as our guests, I'm sure, know, something that's sprayed that high, it doesn't fall straight down onto somebody's lawn or under their head. It's dispersed. It travels miles and miles. So I was not always sure that the accounts that were being given to me could logically be explained. So, Cliff, I want you to address what evidence exists that something really bad, dangerous, poisonous is being spread up there, and can it be shown to be manifesting in health reports and sickness?
Thanks, George. I would say at this point that the evidence indicates that three classes or three types of materials have repeatedly shown up within environmental sampling. This environmental sampling, in my case, takes place at ground level, whatever I can get access to, which is essentially, call it 0 to 12,000 feet, something like that.
Are you there?
Yeah, I sure am. You're not
okay.
There?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Did you hear the last statement, George?
No, why don't you say that again? I heard about the 12,000 feet thing, but go ahead, take it from there.
Yeah, what I was saying was that there's three classes of materials that are showing up repeatedly in the environmental sampling that's taking place, primarily atmospheric rain, soil, whatever is available. And these classes are as follows. The first would be that of ionizable metallic salts. Okay. We'll talk more about that hopefully as time goes on. It's a particular interesting class of materials, actually. Ionizable metallic salts. The second would be that of a rather extraordinary filament material. Again, we can talk about each in detail. And a third class would be that of biological components. Everyone will have to examine that evidence for themselves, but I would say in general that probably three dozen different testing methods have been used over a several-year period. Most of that work was probably done within a 5 to 6 year period. All of the methods of testing, all of the results, all of that work is presented to the public, and anyone that wishes to can either refute or confirm the findings of those tests should they care to do so.
And you think there's a link to Margillan's disease?
Well,
possibly.
I'll answer it simply yes at this point. I'll answer it simply, but then, again, we have to examine what's the rationale or reasoning for that.
Well, what is it? Okay.
I mentioned that one of the classes of material was a very unusual filament nature. There was several cases where you had an unusual filament sample reported, airborne filament sample reported and collected. Now, these fibers are very unusual, and particularly in terms of their size and their physical characteristics. I'll use asbestos as an example to compare to, because many of us are familiar with the health issues related to asbestos fibers. And a human hair is roughly on the order of 60 to 100 microns in thickness, to give a sense of scale, unit of measurement. Asbestos fibers are on the order of 2 microns in thickness. So this tells us that if we have airborne fibers or filaments on the nature of a couple of microns or something like that in the air, that it's legitimate to have some concern about the nature and character of that material. I think that's fair. The materials that I'm speaking of measured at the submicron and do measure at the submicron level. And if anyone were actually to grab what they thought was a filament and put that under examination under the scope, you'll find what you think is a single filament is composed of literally hundreds to thousands of filaments. That filament material was sent to the United States Environmental Protection Agency with a request. I think the request was polite and fair, with a request for identification of that material on behalf of the public welfare, and that there was concern whether it represented a potential health hazard, not knowing the identity of it. This was in 2000. That was done. That documentation, the receipt, certified mail, it's all on the site. The EPA did not acknowledge the physical receipt of that sample. They did correspond, but in their correspondence, they did not acknowledge that they had received this physical sample. They never did.
Well, I guess, you know, in their defense, and I'm, again, just being devil's advocate, somebody out of the blue sends them a sample, says, hey, can you please test this? Take my word for it. It has to do with public health. I can see them not jumping at that.
Well, no, it's not taking my word for it. It's actually, first of all, identify whether there's an issue. You know, I think it's fair to start by, you know, citing the emission statement of the EPA. Go look into what their emission statement is, and it has to do with protection of human health and the environment, okay? Establish whether or not you think there's a legitimate cause for environmental material of an unknown nature and whether or not that is, let's say, relevant to their mission statement. I think that's the issue. It's really not a question of accepting my word for it in particular. I think, and as a matter of fact, I think it's their job to make that determination. But that was never done, and that's the problem.
Clifford, I guess what I'm looking for is sort of the causal link. You know, you have these samples of strange material that you think could represent a health effect. I guess what I wanted to know is how do you know that the samples come from planes that are sprayed and that they cause disease? Track the causal link from spraying to sickness.
One has absolutely no way of knowing that they come directly from an airplane unless you retrieve that sample from an airplane. You won't find a single statement in any of my work over 10 years that says any single sample came from an airplane.
Okay.
Simply not available. All right?
Understood. Understand why I'd ask that, though. If you're making a link to, say, Morgellons from this strange material, you know, there's some missing pieces, right?
I'm making a link between certain environmental samples and the chronicle of those samples over the years and the failure of certain agencies to let's say, act on behalf of the public welfare, and then the, by necessity, independent research by civilians over an extended period of time, which indicates more than a parallel, but indicates a high degree of correspondence between certain biological components and their direct, let's say, it's not even a connection, their direct existence within these environmental samples and the failure of those agencies to properly investigate the issue. You know, you asked about what official responses were.
Right.
I probably spent, you know, 2 to 3 years of my work, a good part of that is detailing and citing the official response. I have a whole page devoted to every. It's not just me. I acted on behalf of citizens across the country that made numerous repeated and reasonable requests for investigation of concerns to themselves with respect to health and environment. The responses of those parties and or officials and agencies are very clear, and they're all listed and cited on a page. You'll find a page called Official Responses, and that process failed. Okay? That process failed. The citizens actually did their part. They did the proper and right thing. Unfortunately, they never did receive a proper and appropriate response.
CDC, did you try them?
Not directly. As a matter of fact, I'm not acting as the primary party there. CDC is heavily involved now in terms of the Morgellons issue. Okay, there are people that have been doing the same thing with respect to the CDC requesting certain analyses with respect to the so-called. Again, some of these terms are problematic in themselves, but the CDC is certainly involved with the Morgellons issue.
You at least think that there is a correlation, if not causation, between spraying something or these chemicals and Morgellons?
Well, first of all, you'll notice I never use the word chemtrails. I have a problem with that term to begin with.
Okay.
That term has no definition whatsoever. no acceptance by the formal community in any way, and it implies a certain type of knowledge that, number one, is not in place, and it also is restrictive in terms of its interpretation of what these elements are. The term that I use is aerosol. It may not be an exciting term, but the term is accurate as best as I can determine in terms of what we're actually talking about. And an aerosol is a particle in suspension in a gas or a liquid. And what I'm speaking of is the deliberate dissemination and introduction of massive amounts of particulate matter, extremely fine materials, into the atmosphere. Okay, so these terms are problematic in themselves. And when we use the word spray and chemtrails, there are certain associations that take place that, let's say, lead one to a distraction, I believe, without considering the actual nature of the evidence and analysis that's been done. It's straightforward. We're talking about human citizens, beings on the ground, that have limited access to resources, but they've done the best that they can to analyze this in environmentals because of the failure of the supposed authoritative agencies to do their part in accomplishing this.
As an analyst, as a scientist, a computer consultant, you would have to admit that some of these samples could come from somewhere other than spraying or aerosols or planes.
Absolutely. Until, again, any work that I do, you will find the source identified as to where it came from. You'll find out where it was taken, how it was taken, what was taken. Every sample that is to be documented and presented in any kind of serious fashion has to have the surrounding documentation and evidence to have any meaning.
I want to ask a question of both of you. We'll start with Will and then back to you, Cliff. What that's always bothered me in this discussion is that you've got a program. It's not a little tiny program. It's a worldwide program. It's huge. There's got to be thousands of people involved in it. And, in those biological experiments that have been conducted by our government in previous years, they were small kinds of programs where you could keep a secret. It would seem to me it'd be pretty tough to keep a secret, even from the thousands of guys who would have to be involved in this thing. And the part that bothers me most is you got these servicemen who are spraying stuff, hypothetically, spraying stuff over their own country, over the country where they live, where their families live, their mom, their dad, their kids. You would think that one of them would come forward. Will, what do you do when people raise that question? What's your answer?
As a former member of the military, I can say that we all joined the U.S. Military or other militaries with the firm notion of helping people and protecting people, particularly our own people. And I'm certain that air crews are being told that they are protecting their country and their families from a potent threat, whether it's a biological threat from a terrorist attack or whether it's a climate change threat. And they are willingly doing these missions. And I would think that most of them would have no desire or interest in coming forward for a program that they agree with.
And Cliff, the same question to you.
Well, I think the first thing you'd have to ask is whether or not you think to the best of your ability. We're talking about benign intentions or covert operations. There's problems on both sides, because if it's benign, then why the heck wouldn't you talk about it? If this thing is benign and has any supposed, climate mitigation intention, something like that, you would talk about it if something is beneficial. So there's a problem with that to begin with. If it's a covert operation, then it gets a little bit more serious and difficult. And I would answer your question by asking another question just to start the discussion, because I certainly hear this question come up. I'm aware of it. It's a very sensible question. But I would start by asking, was the Manhattan Project a success? Did that project succeed? And if it did succeed, what was one of the main reasons that it succeeded? That would be a starter. Okay?
Secrecy, sure.
The second thing that I would say, that if you accepted the premise that these were covert operations, the obvious thing that any one of us want to know, or those that are trying to find out about a covert operation, you want to know these five W's. You want the simple, obvious questions answered. Who, what, when, where, and why. Everybody wants it, and everybody wants it in one sentence. Now, I'm asking you to imagine that if you actually did create, if there was such a thing of a covert operation on the scale that I'm speaking of, would you design that project so that those questions could be answered? I will tell you, and I'm not, but if I was in charge of designing that system, I wouldn't even let you get close to these five W's. It's not a matter of getting partial answers. I would not let you get close to the true verifiable answers to the intent or nature of that covert operation. This is a partial response.
Yeah. Like, for example, you add something, somebody adds something to jet fuel. The jet fuel is loaded onto planes. All the people along down the chain don't know that they're actually participating in this.
You know, what is the nature of a covert operation? You have layers. You have so many layers. You have the necessary layers of protection. And it's layer upon layer if needed. And I think it is hard for many of us to actually, if you can imagine it, what that layer is, then the folks designing the program have not done their job properly. If that layer is not protected, that covert operation is not intact.
Yeah, I would say the difference between something like this and the Manhattan Project would be that people developing the Manhattan Project weren't developing a bomb to drop on the United States. They were developing a bomb to drop on our enemies, and that would be a difference here. But a passive program where, say, you put something in jet fuel or where you install in civilian airlines some kind of spraying mechanism without the knowledge of the airline pilots or the airline industry, I mean, William, are you saying that that could be a possibility?
I have trouble with that in that an airline captain in charge of an aircraft full of passengers, if she or he got wind of this, I doubt whether they would fly that airplane. They have the command authority to say, I am not flying an improperly modified airplane and participating in something that I have not been informed of. They have the command right to do that. So although there have been allegations online that pilots and airline personnel have been told to participate and keep it secret. As a captain of a small boat at sea, making the extension to an airliner, I can't see that conscientious captains would participate. At least some of them would break ranks.
Well, then, there we are. It's sort of an impasse then, aren't we? Because, something this big, I guess you could have layers and keep most of the people involved out of the loop. Somewhere along the line, somebody knows about it. And as we were discussing earlier in the show, Clifford, we don't really have the smoking gun document. We don't really have the tell-all whistleblower to come forward, at least not yet.
Absolutely not. I am involved in this research now for a decade of my life, not out of desire. It is out of necessity. This is why I'm doing it, because there has been an abject failure of those who would act on behalf and are chartered to act on behalf of the public welfare to protect and preserve that welfare. There has been an abject failure. Again, one will have to determine and decide whether or not they believe that would occur because of a benign project, of which we should all be talking about and have disclosed and have your discussions, or whether or not it is a covert operation where it is never intended that that investigation even be remotely considered as a possibility.
Is there one thing, one statistic from public health data that you can point to that says, that's pretty interesting right there, that's different, maybe it's related to this? I know causality is hard to come by, but something that pops out of the pages of public health data at you.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think William, and good evening, William. I know we didn't get a chance to say hello, but, I know we have an interesting case where you have basically a changing of the standards of what an epidemic is early in the game. I think it's probably around 2002 plus or minus a year or so, where you have this changing of the standards as to what represents an epidemic. That record is out there, and that change in standard apparently occurred because of a most unusual spike in the data that caused the necessity for redefinition. Is there, again, a smoking gun, the single thing? No way. It's not out there. The CDC has not responded. Again, there's been a failure. They have not responded properly.
Okay, Clifford, we're going to take a break now. We'll jump back into this question. We're right in the heart of our discussion of chemtrails with William Thomas and Clifford Carnicum. And joining us in a couple of minutes, Mark Allen from Above Top Secret. Stay with us. We're just getting started here on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating discussion about chemtrails. William Thomas has been here since the beginning of the program. He's the author of Chemtrails Confirmed. Cliff Carnicum joined us an hour ago to add his perspective. And I appreciate that our guests recognize that there are some gaps in the evidence here. There's a lot of smoke, but not a lot of fire. They've been looking at circumstantial evidence and hints from government documents, things of that sort. But both admit we don't quite have a smoking gun bit of evidence yet, no definitive whistleblower who's come forward to talk about this. Maybe it's sort of like a sign of the times. You know, we have a lot of uncertainty in our lives, a lot of suspicion, concerns about new world order, things of that sort. Government intentions not always being in the public's best interest. And if it is a sign of the times, if we live in an age of conspiracy, there are those who point the finger at the Internet, that it is possibly fueled by the Internet. And my guest coming on now is an expert in that field. His name is Mark Allen. He's one of the co-founders of AboveTopSecret.com, just about the largest conspiracy paranormal website in the world. Mark, you there?
Hi, George.
Hey, thanks for being with us. I hope you've been able to listen to some of the conversation so far.
I absolutely have, and it's been fascinating and enlightening, actually, and a lot better than I have to admit than I thought it was going to be.
Well, I think it's been pretty good, too. Tell me this. You look at the big picture on Above Top Secret. You get all kinds of conspiracy theories. You get millions of people coming onto your site every month. Is there is it zeitgeist? Is it the sign of the times that people worry about conspiracies like this? And is it in part fueled by the Internet, the engine that pays your bills?
You know, I think it's interesting. It's a double-edged sword, the Internet. For the first time in human history, all of us are able to talk to each other pretty much at the speed of, literally at the speed of light. So that's a very new thing. And I think that, you know, the fact that everybody can talk to everybody, and when someone sees something or hears about something that doesn't make sense or doesn't add up, or better yet, conflicts with what they heard on the mainstream media or their government has told them, they're going to talk about it, and they're going to get a voice on AboveTopSecret.com that reaches out to millions of people. So the answer to your question is yes, I think that these things are definitely spurred on the Internet, but I also think that there's a whole lot out there that we really do need to worry about that we should be talking to each other about.
Agreed. Tell me this, on Above Top Secret, you get all kinds of topics discussed every day. The subject of chemtrails, I know, comes up. How often?
You know, I just dug through those numbers today, surprisingly, because I knew we were going to be talking about them tonight. Interestingly enough, chemtrails represents about less than 1% of our traffic. So less than 1% of what the hundreds of thousands of members, registered members, who you know, provide content and speak up on the site through their posts are actually talking about chemtrails.
But it is ongoing. It is spirited.
It is absolutely ongoing, and those that do discuss it are very spirited, no question about it.
Do you have a position on chemtrails? Do you have a point of view?
You know, I prefer to express what our members think, for obvious reasons.
Well, what's the prevailing view among your members then?
The prevailing view among the membership is, you know, if this was such a covert and dark and deep secret operation as it's, you know, portrayed to be, there's one huge problem. Well, there's several huge problems, but the first major huge problem is you have no control over what you spray 38,000 feet up in the sky. So if you're trying to control people or make certain people sick, well, you're going to make your own people sick because you're squirting the stuff out at 38,000 feet. There's absolutely no control. I mean, the winds and everything else, and I would love to pose this question to the other guests. You know, how do you account for that? You're spraying aerosols out at 38,000 feet or 30,000 feet or 40,000 feet. This stuff is going to go everywhere. I mean, the winds, I fly so much that I know that the winds are crazy up there, and the stuff's going to disperse everywhere. So what are you looking to gain out of this without killing your own family?
I think Cliff's answer to that, and Cliff, you can state it for yourself. Your answer to that is that the people spraying the stuff don't know what they're spraying?
People do their job, okay, in terms of at least the structure of a covert operation. People do their job. The whole need-to-know philosophy that's inherent in the design of the structure. What should they know, and what do they have the right to know?
Well, not so much the people spraying it, but the guys who ordered the spraying. Are they not going to worry about their family members, getting... And this is purely a question that's being asked by hundreds of thousands of people on this topic. So, the guy who pushes the button and says, okay, we're going to send this jet up 38,000 feet, we're going to spray barium in the air, we're going to spray this in the air, is he not worried about his family breathing that in?
Did you want me to respond, George?
Sure, go ahead.
The first thing that one would need to do is identify the party that is managing the operation, party or parties, right? We're making possibly certain assumptions about what level that decision process is being made. I think that is a necessary question to answer before you even begin to answer the question of who's deciding what impact has whatever. You don't even have the parties identified. Number two, I would raise the question if somebody's saying you have no control. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. Number one, the first thing you would do is decide the scale of the operation. You have no control if you're trying to target a five-mile area? Possibly, but even that's not necessarily the case. But the scale of the operation would be a partial answer as to whether or not you have control or not. There's no question that this is a global operation, and the scale of the operation should be considered as global, and the control issues should be also viewed as very potentially, very likely to be global in nature. Secondly, when you consider the possibility of the introduction of energy sources, and in particular directed energy sources, and you get into the electromagnetics of these operations, you allow for the potential of very direct, I hope we're still there, the phone dropped, but very, very direct control of energy transfer upon a specific location or a region. It's quite possible that it could be at a level of control that many of us would have a difficult time imagining. The third point I wanted to make, and this is, I'll try to keep it brief, but I do not regard the evidence that is available to us as being circumstantial at all. And I think those that say they wish to consider the evidence need to look at the physical observational analytical evidence, which is available, and evaluate that properly, and that it's not circumstantial at all. That would be my opinion.
Well, circumstantial in this sense is what I meant by that comment, Clifford, is that you have evidence, but the links between the physical evidence that you have and the planes is not necessarily always there, and the link then to diseases, for example, is not always there. But we're going to jump back into that, and I want to ask William Thomas, who had said at the beginning he felt it was an Air Force program, whether or not it has evolved into something else that other agencies or entities are involved. But we'll get into that after this break with our guests talking about chemtrails here on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us here on Coast to Coast to talk about chemtrails. William Thomas, in the beginning of the program, you talked about Air Force involvement in this. Has it expanded beyond that, do you think? Do you suspect?
No, they're the only ones capable. The U.S. Air Force is the only one with the aircraft that is hundreds of tanker planes available to carry out a program that's now been ongoing virtually every day for nearly 11 years. And I would say that alone rules out a deliberate biowarfare campaign. There's simply not enough biowarfare agents on this planet to fulfill even a fraction of such a mission. And I'm convinced that the only thing that would require nearly daily spraying for such a long time period would be this sunscreen application. I also agree with your guest that there is absolutely no control of these particles spread at altitude, and if you were deliberately targeting a segment of the population that did not include your top political leaders, military leaders, the managers and bankers who ran your society, you would use vaccines to deliver these targeted agents, not something like chemtrails.
Clifford, do you have any indication that this has gone beyond the Air Force, that maybe there's another entity directing it, intelligence agency of some sort?
Again, the parties are not identified, and what I do is look at the physical environmental evidence that's
right.
available to me. You know, the question of whether or not, let's call it the airplane, is the source, at one point almost becomes a moot point, okay? If you're looking at environmental change and effect, at some point, if the environment has been sufficiently changed and the deed is done, yes, you can spend our life trying to find out whether indeed it is the plane, okay, that is the source. But my contention is that we're far beyond the implications at this point of needing necessarily to have the final question answered and decided as to whether or not the aircraft is the ultimate source of the impact. The atmosphere of this planet has been changed. It has been physically changed. And if you don't think that's possible, it's quite possible because it's been done. 3/4 of the mass of the atmosphere is contained in a layer roughly 7 miles thick. The atmosphere of this planet is very fragile. And, you know, I've looked at this from a logistical standpoint, and it is possible to literally physically change the constitution of the atmosphere. And my claim is that it has been done. So that effect is there. Everyone can go through the evidence for themselves and decide whether or not they accept that proposition or not. But, you know, my work at this point is not at the level. I spent 3 years probably photographing airplanes, okay? I spent probably 5 years doing environmental sampling and analysis. For the past 3 years, I've been involved in biological aspects of this, and I have to say that I certainly do not agree that it is impossible to consider that biological operations of global scale have resulted or can result from operations of this nature. I would very definitely disagree with that.
And Mark, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And if we review the evidence that's available, unfortunately, it's more than, let's say, a concern. It's more than a concern, the level of evidence that I'm talking about in terms of ubiquity and pervasiveness of the biological information and distribution. And each of us, if we actually get a little bit curious and start examining our own biology with some fairly simple tests, and it may be that many of us that are listening actually have a legitimate right to be asking some questions about their own biology.
Well, I would say we all have that right. Mark, Allen, I'm going back to you. The other kinds of concerns, you mentioned the first one that have been raised by ATS members. What are the others?
Well, you know, we took a look at the sampling that I believe Clifford did with the barium levels. And there were some issues there with the math. And playing devil's advocate myself, just a question straight up. Apparently you guys took a vacuum cleaner that had a HEPA filter in it and pulled air in for about an hour. Was what I read on your site. And then you based the ratio on the total amount of particulate matter that the filter trapped without taking into account the volume of air that the vacuum cleaner took in. Is that correct, or am I misreading that?
Yeah, I do want to say good evening to you also, Mark. Thank you for the opportunity to meet you. I will say that it is apparent to me that the speaker has no awareness of any particular test of that nature on my site. You will not find that specific test that is described on my site.
I apologize.
You guys, unfortunately, does not apply to me. My work is done almost entirely as an independent researcher. I have no affiliation with any group other than a nonprofit I have created. And you will find extensive, let's say, reports on my analysis of the barium issue, and they have absolutely no coincidence with the particular event that you're describing.
William, do you have barium stuff on your site? Could Mark be talking about you?
I do have barium stuff on my site and in my book, Chemtrails Confirmed, and I'm pointing to the state of California government study and statement saying that barium levels are significantly higher in that state in recent years, and they don't know why. I go that far. I like government sources, George.
I do, too. That's what I was wondering, in talking about something of this scale. There's atmospheric testing of all sorts all the time by different labs and scientists and agencies. I was wondering if something has popped up, if anyone has found something that shouldn't be there. Anyone?
I have spent probably 2 years working on the barium issue. I have probably written a half a dozen papers on that issue, and those tests are fully described. And the conclusions from those papers are also evident to anyone that wishes to read them. And the conclusion is that the existence of unusual levels of barium compounds in the atmosphere are very much a legitimate and reasonable concern based upon those tests.
Mark, anything to add?
Yeah, it was Clifford's site that I saw that on. I'm actually looking at it now, and that's interesting. Anyway, getting past that, the other thing that really intrigues our membership is it seems that the whole chemtrail phenomenon started about somewhere around 11 to 15 years ago. And if that's not a fair statement, I'm willing to expand that range to whatever needs to be expanded. And coincidentally, regional jet flights increased dramatically at the same, the same point in time. And if we looked, at the number of flights going across America, I happened to pull up for yesterday. There's 43,000 tracked commercial flights yesterday. On a Saturday, just over America. And those are the flights that are tracked publicly and easily available on the Internet. So that excludes classified military flights and the obvious stuff that's not going to be tracked. So my question is, could there not be a correlation between people seeing these tremendous amounts of contrails in the sky, getting worried because they really did kind of all of a sudden appear in the sky? I mean, crosshatches and checkerboard patterns, which, if you really look at the flight paths, there's a pretty logical explanation for that stuff. There's flights literally checkerboarding the sky above America daily, 43,000 of them on a Saturday. And I'd just like to hear the guest's response to that.
William got into this a little bit. You touched on it briefly. You think you can account for the increase in the air traffic, right?
Absolutely. I think it's a valid point. It's a very strong point. But here's the answer to it, I believe. Not overnight. In two words, not overnight. Yes, a major increase in air traffic over years, even decades. Absolutely. But people were seeing these concentrated plumes literally overnight from one day to the next. And they would go on, according to hundreds of reports in my files, they would go on for days, maybe a week, and then disappear. And then maybe reappear a month later and continue for weeks. That is not the sign of a scheduled airline route or routes. Many of these sightings took place away from omni-navigational beacons where airliners tend to congregate and crisscross. They took place in rural communities that were unused to seeing commercial traffic. I'm talking in one case out in Maine. St. Brent got involved and actually tracked down Deep Sky, our source, with air traffic control after she and her husband counted 25 jets in the space of about an hour, and they were used to seeing maybe one or two a day. She called up her radio station. The whole staff went outside. They counted 300 aircraft spreading these trails that afternoon. They never saw that again. So, no, these are sporadic and significant increases in aircraft trails, often over areas that are not regularly visited by this amount of traffic.
Fair enough. William Thomas, Clifford Carnicum, and Mark Allen are my guests talking about chemtrails. We'll be back with much more, and we'll be opening up the phone lines a little bit later for your questions and calls. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. I want to get into the issue of HAARP because it comes up in association with all sorts of different conspiracy-type topics. William, you're not going to be with us after the top of the hour, so I want to start with you. Do you think there's a HAARP connection to this?
I'm certain of that. I'm certain of that, absolutely. Again, we have the scientists at Lawrence from Lawrence Livermore stating that very plainly that HAARP was involved. My own personal source that I've worked with for many years talked to me at length and in great detail about the use of HAARP and reactive chemicals sprayed in the air on the approach of Hurricane Katrina. And he asserts that it actually was used to turn that hurricane away from Texas and the Johnson Space Center, and unfortunately it hit New Orleans with the consequences we've all seen. Interestingly enough, George, in my new edition of Chemtrails Confirmed, I have actual published graphs of the HAARP emanations showing dramatic and quite significant spikes. One when when Katrina made its landfall on Florida, and a second one as it approached the Louisiana coast. Very interesting information, as well as a description by a gentleman who interviewed many survivors of Hurricane Charley, who described physical symptoms, emotional and psychological symptoms that seemed to indicate they had been interfered with by electromagnetic radiation, possibly used to steer Charley and other hurricanes as well. I'm thinking of Hurricane Francis and Ivan in connection with something called Dynagel, a desiccant that was actually seen washing up on the shores outside of Palm Beach at that very time. So I think HAARP is implicated in chemtrails and in hurricane modification.
Clifford Carnicum, do you agree, or does HAARP show up in your research as well?
Absolutely, it does, quite extensively. My pathway to considering the issue of HAARP was not by assuming that HAARP was relevant and then finding information that coincided with that. It was exactly the opposite. My work followed a series of environmental sampling that led me to conclude the existence of a particular class of materials occurring in unusual and expected numbers. And that particular class of materials is what I referred to earlier as ionizable metallic salts. This does start to introduce the electromagnetic aspects of these operations, because an ionizable metallic salt is an interesting entity, and that is, you're talking about basically a particulate that has the ability to become electrically charged if it is subjected to sufficient energy. Two sources of energy that can be considered here would be, number one, the sun. It is actually possible with certain types of elements, particularly those in group two, group one and group two of the periodic table, to actually become electrically charged with the energy available within sunlight, particularly the ultraviolet spectrum. In addition, one could introduce energy into the atmosphere, and certainly HAARP, that's really what that place is about, is introducing energy via the magnetic field into the atmosphere. So my work, my path, was that of finding the existence of a particular class of materials and then asking the question, what application is consistent with the existence of those materials? What would you do with those types of materials? And that brings up the question of what's called, issue of what's called a plasma state. And, you know, many of us are familiar with the ionosphere, where you have a layer around the Earth that has a layer of charged particles. That is a plasma. A plasma is an electrically conductive gas. And my work indicates strongly that we must now open up to consideration the alteration of the atmosphere in general, and no longer can we restrict ourselves to the unusual properties of just the ionosphere when it comes to the propagation and transfer of energy. If you then ask what type of operation is consistent with a envelope, essentially, of an electrically conductive gas surrounding the Earth, HAARP does come into play, whether we like it or not. And it is at that point that I started to study the HAARP patent. It's not exactly a bedtime reading, but and it was when I started out. But I have spent extensive time reading that patent. And what I can say is that the overlap and the coincidence between the physical principles and energy systems described within a particular patent. A patent is nothing more than an idea. It's not necessarily a deployment, but certainly this patent is completely consistent in all physical and energy considerations with the alteration of the atmosphere that has taken place.
Mark, I know that HAARP shows up all over the place on your site. You had mentioned before that chemtrails as a topic is a pretty small one in the vast scope of various conspiracies. What about HAARP, though?
HAARP is huge. But to address the question at hand, the meteorologists who are obviously, you know, very interested in these topics, or they wouldn't be on AboveTopSecret.com. And the pilots who frequent our site, who have commented on both HAARP and chemtrails, you know, we just revert back to what I said moments ago, that if you wanted to conduct an experiment with HAARP and you wanted to maximize or increase the effectiveness of HAARP in the layers of the atmosphere, one of the worst ways you could do that would be to spray an aerosol from a jet at 38 or 58 or, you know, 48,000 feet, because you have no control. And I would also like to add before William goes that, you know, if you can bring up any of these radio station people that saw, you know, the sky that you mentioned before the break, and I apologize for going back to something before the break, but I really want to get this in. AboveTopSecret.com, we have a news program. And, you know, if you could present some folks that would step up and, you know, just say that, and a group of them, multiple witnesses, we will be the biggest allies that you or these people have ever had. And that's really all we're asking for, is somebody step up, multiple witnesses, verifiable, you know, pictures, anything, and we'll support you. And I just wanted to get that in before William left.
Well, I think we all agree with that, and William and Clifford have both addressed it before. It would be nice to have that. I guess it is what it is at this point.
We do have plenty of eyewitnesses, photographs, and videotape of people who have come forward. As I mentioned, some of them professionally trained observers, not involved with the program, but understanding that they were seeing something very unusual. And in terms of HAARP, I might quickly add that I actually called up Dr. Bernard Eastland, the inventor of HAARP. I caught him at his barbecue in Texas one afternoon, and I said, what's the purpose of HAARP? What was your intention in developing this apparatus? And his immediate answer was weather modification. That was the primary purpose. There are many others, but that was the primary purpose, he told me, behind his invention that called HAARP. Interestingly, that after I started writing about chemtrails for Environment News Service, Bernard Eastland wrote me an email, and he said that the experiments I was describing seemed technically feasible, that is, using HAARP and in conjunction with chemtrails. And he said that to heat up the atmosphere with HAARP was very difficult. It would go right through the atmosphere unless you put some elements in that airspace that it could heat. And he suggested that polymers would work very well in allowing HAARP to be directed to heat certain sections of the atmosphere. And, in fact, we've been seeing, as Clifford mentioned, cobweb-like material, polymer material all over the United States and other locations in conjunction with airplanes flying overhead, emitting something out of the back end of them. And Eastland went further, and he said that the heat generation occurs by adding magnetic iron oxide powder to the polymer. And that really got me going, because one of my very first stories on this subject, I interviewed a person in Tennessee, Mr. Farmer, who had worked with Raytheon Corporation, and he suggested that iron oxide was showing up in the chemtrails that he had analyzed. And Eastland finally said that two specific polymers, Freqion B20 and F5 PPS polymers, are sensitive to the 1 to 50 megahertz frequencies, and that HARP, he said, operates between 2 and 10 megahertz in that range. And he further noted that those polymers are made by a manufacturer in Ohio close to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which, of course, is in charge of the HARP program.
You know, I understand that Mark and even myself were still a little bit what you would call skeptical, not hostile to this topic, but skeptical, asking questions about it. And that comes with the territory as a reporter for me.
Sure.
But I look back at the troubling thing for me in a larger sense, the historical precedent. You know, the idea that our government could spray something without our knowledge over the citizenry, potentially bad effects, seems preposterous on its face. And yet you look at the historical record, and there are programs where the government sprayed stuff on unwitting civilian populations as tests over the years. I would imagine, Clifford, that you've looked into that.
Look at the Senate hearings held in 1977 and acquire a document that is entitled Biological Testing Involving Human Subjects by the Department of Defense. This is a set of Senate hearings. That document's a little bit hard to get a hold of, but it's out there, U.S. Government Printing Office, in the past. Apparently it's not available now, but it's out there. And this document is a record of Senate hearings that were held in 1977 that discussed in a public venue the very issue that George is referring to, and that is the disclosure in a public sense of the chronicle of aerosol tests as well, but in general, biological tests conducted upon the citizens of this country without their knowledge or consent. And so if someone does ask if there is a precedent for this issue, the answer is yes, and it actually dates back to the day that it could be done. If you had a means of doing it, and in particular aircraft are suitable, you will find references to aerosol operations within this document. You will find references to the biowarfare military aspect in these documents. And the fact is they were done, and this is a case in 77 where we had the fortunate and rare opportunity to actually bring these to light, and those particular episodes were for decades preceding this, 77. It wasn't anything about something happening in 77. These were things that were brought to light from the 50s and the 60s. So even if you had the willingness and desire to hold public forums, you are, without any doubt, going to be dealing with a lag of often decades in terms of the type of information and technical capability of what it is you're even considering.
William, I don't have your book, Chemtrails Confirmed, but I would imagine you go into this, some of the examples of these kinds of testing programs on unsuspecting, unwitting civilian populations.
Absolutely. I was just adding that to my latest revision of the 2010 version of the book, be released by January 10th. And I do go into this. Clifford Carnegie is absolutely correct in citing this long-standing program that was completely covert and kept from the knowledge of the American public. And we have Gulf War illness, which I'm very well acquainted with, and the biological and chemical warfare that occurred in the Gulf. And that, too, was poo-pooed and denigrated by the U.S. government and other agencies for many years. And 10 years later, finally, they came out and admitted that this, in fact, had occurred. So maybe someday we will get an admission that chemtrails are real, are serious. And I want to emphasize that while I don't believe this is a intentional biological program for the reasons I stated, it absolutely, these particulates are absolutely making many people sick, killing people, not intentionally, but the small particulate size we're talking about, 10 microns, has been cited by the EPA as an extreme human health hazard. Those are their words. And they say that if people inhale fine particulates. They were talking ground level pollution, but any kind of airborne particulate of this size, they are in grave trouble of heart problems, respiratory problems, allergies, and worse from just the particulate size, let alone any possible toxicity. And finally, I'll note that
I was concerned early on that these chemicals sprayed at altitude, and again, we have radar-confirmed sighting that this has been going on. We're bringing down to Earth viruses, bacteria, and fungi that live and breed in the upper atmosphere and are totally unknown, virtually unknown to the human immune system, and that if they were precipitated out of the air by so-called chemtrails, they would make people very ill indeed. And I was stunned to see that the scientists quoted by Bob Fitrakis in Columbus Alive at Wright-Patterson said without prompting that they were concerned that this very thing was happening, that these pathogens were being brought down to ground level. There are biological effects. They are serious. And as Clifford said, they are global.
Mark, you want to jump into that one? I mean, I would imagine that your membership, you and your membership, would be interested in the historical record of cases where government agencies have performed these kinds of heinous tests without the knowledge of private citizens and sometimes troops.
Without question. And we've looked deeply into the incidents mentioned, and from everything we can tell, it's absolutely true. But again, you know, these weren't dispersed at 38,000 feet. And I really hate to keep coming back to that, but all the science and all the professionals that I've personally talked to and all the people that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of them that post on the site, that continuously is the big hang-up with the chemtrail thing, is you're up there in the way up in the atmosphere. The winds can cross. You've got the jet stream. You just have no control. But there's absolutely no doubt that the U.S. government has done some nefarious deeds in the past. No question about it. And that's one of the concerns that a lot of our membership has about focusing on, you know, 38,000 feet up in the sky and in the upper atmosphere where there's virtually no control based on meteorological science, that it's diverting attention away from things like what was just discussed. You know, real nefarious deeds done at very low level with crop dusters or, you know, allowing people to go into a space and pumping the HVAC system with aerosols. Those are terrible things.
Mark, can I jump in, please?
Sure.
Very important. I want to emphasize, Mark, chemtrails, after 11 years of investigation, I'm convinced chemtrails, the purpose is not, repeat, not, emphasize not biological warfare. There's not enough agents. And again, to do this so consistently over 11 years, I'm convinced the only possible reason to have to continuously spray this material is to maintain some kind of sky shield or sunscreen. But this is not a deliberate program to make people sick or cull the population. It certainly is a byproduct, an unintended consequence of spraying fine particulates that do make people sick. But I absolutely agree. There's no control, and there's not enough agents to make this a continual biowarfare project.
Hey, Will, we have about a minute left in this segment before we take a break and William leaves us. Anything else to add, William, where the research goes from here?
Well, I just want to say that, again, after 11 years, we can say that these are chemicals. We have lab tests. I have actual lab tests in my possession of particulates falling through chemtrails being analyzed by private labs in Edmonton, Alberta, and Espanola, Ontario. It's in the book. It's on my website. We can say that there are chemical constituents, aluminum oxide in particular, barium, even quartz. We can also say that government officials in the FAA have confirmed, repeatedly confirmed, air traffic controllers have confirmed that these are Air Force tankers and they are spraying something that appears on their radar scopes. As far as where this is going, I am extremely concerned that given the dangers of small particulate inhalation and consequent health problems, the shift to nanoparticles by the U.S. Air Force in its weather control program will pose an urgent and extreme human health hazard, among other considerations.
William Thomas, we are glad you were here. I hope you're wrong. The book is called Chemtrails Confirmed, new version coming out in a couple of weeks. back into our final hour of this program discussing chemtrails. Thanks again to William Thomas for being with us. I was blabbing and it cut off the website where you can reach him. It's willthomasonline.net if you want to send him a note or get more information. Clifford Carnicum will be staying with us and taking your calls for the final hour. His website, carnicum.com. And, of course, Mark Allen from AboveTopSecret.com, maybe the biggest conspiracy paranormal website in the world. Mark, while Gina is lining up some calls for us, take a minute before we take this next break. Take a minute and tell us what else is going on your site.
Well, thank you, George. We've got a great, very germane to this topic, we've got a great news edition, episode number 4. People go to the website, AboveTopSecret.com, look up, there's a little new video/media button up there. If they'll click that and go to episode number 4 of the ATS News, they'll see a news edition all about the patent that was released and given to a defense contractor for chemtrails, which I think is very germane to this. And I think the news show is something everyone who enjoys and is interested in these topics should check out.
Okay. You got something else from a friend of ours that's on there, a guy named Dr. Kit Green.
Yes, we do. And I personally flew up to Detroit a couple weeks ago. We interviewed Dr. Christopher Kit Green, the one and only, and all about the H1N1 virus, the vaccines associated with it, and a whole lot of information everybody really needs to hear in that video. And, you know, George, we have some stuff from you with Corso up there, too.
You know, I'm envious of you for that Kit Green interview. I tried to get him on the program a couple of times. I guess I'm not as persuasive as you, but if the listeners don't know who he is, Kit Green is sort of a Fox Mulder. I mean, he was on the weird desk for the CIA for a long time. Very interesting guy. All right, we're lining up phone calls for Clifford Carnicum and Mark Allen. When we come back, we'll get to the phones. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're going into the phones with your questions about chemtrails for our guests, Clifford Carnicum and Mark Allen. Wildcard Line, Santa Monica, California. Is the name Talon? Talon?
Yes. The question I had was, they were always talking about they're putting barium particles in through the streams in the air and whatnot. Why? What is the purpose or the outcome that they think the government's trying to do?
Well, we discussed a couple of possibilities. Cliff, you want to take that one?
Well, barium is an element that has many interesting properties. One of the strongest is its electrical nature. This is an element that, when subjected to sufficient energy and the right type of energy, as we discussed earlier, can become electrically charged. And if you can electrically charge a particle, extreme, and by the way, the nature of the size that I'm speaking of here is not 10 microns. I'm speaking at the submicron level for almost everything that I'm speaking of tonight. But you can alter the electrodynamic properties of the atmosphere. Specifically, if a person really would like to take the time to read the HARP patent, you will find a specific reference to the deliberate introduction of barium elements for the very specific reason that I am speaking of. And to say that if you want to do it, it has to be done somehow. So if you're considering the atmosphere as your scale, not a place, but your scale of operation, the planet, the globe, as your scale of operation, it is the atmosphere that requires modification. The HARP patent will make, just in a couple of minutes I've been here, I found 3 explicit references to the deliberate introduction of particulate matter, specifically for the purpose of enhancing what's called electron density, the ionization level of the atmosphere. So there are very deliberate purposes to which specific compounds or elements can be placed.
Mark, I know you guys took a look at this patent, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. Again, God, I just feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again. The patent, nowhere in the patent does it say we're going to squirt it out the back of a jet at 38,000 feet where it could just pretty much go anywhere. I would think that with all the great, brilliant minds we have, there would be a whole lot better ways to apply that stuff if you're going to apply it for these purposes than randomly flying jets back and forth across the sky.
Cliff, you want to address that?
Well, I think you need to define your methods. I mean, actually, you've got to do it somehow. You're after modifying the atmosphere. What's a sensible method by which that would be done? Like I said, aerosols have a history back to the 40s and the 50s. When it could be done, it was done. There's nothing particularly unusual. You know, take a look. Take a look at the research projects related to aerosols. You could spend your life studying deliberate aerosol introduction into the atmosphere and the studies that are done with it. You know, one cannot say it's not a viable means. In fact, it's actually a very sensible means if you're dealing with modifying the atmosphere. Remember, three-quarters of the mass was within 7 miles. You know, what's the common level which aircraft can fly? Up to 7 miles.
So sensible to modify the atmosphere, not necessarily to deliver an agent to a specific target.
Well, you have to set the stage, number one. In other words, if you're after creating a particular modified environment, you need to do that first. After you've done it, then you need to determine how you're going to use that modified environment. And like I said, there's a lot of possibilities there once you have control and direction of energy.
Well, let's look at it from a scale perspective. You know, you have how many jets would it take squirting out how much barium into the air to have any effect on the atmosphere anywhere? And I ask this in all honesty because I don't know. But in my mind, it would take a whole heck of a lot of planes, thousands, I would think, shooting barium to get enough of it concentrated to the levels required. And that's, you know, taking into consideration the winds are going to disperse it who knows where. But would you not agree, Clifford, that it would take a heck of a lot of aircraft to do that?
You know, I've done a paper on this subject if we want to read it or find it. And it brought up that very question. And the question is it physically feasible? Is it feasible to modify the atmosphere using aircraft? And we'll have to find that paper. It's out here. We'll dig them all up somewhere. But the conclusion from that paper was that, yes, it is feasible. Imagine a layer 7 miles thick. Okay, it's a trip down to the grocery store. 7 miles thick is a majority of the medium in which we're speaking. Okay, it's fragile. It is quite possible to alter the chemistry. And, you know, you can ask the question of whether or not the atmosphere has been modified by simply looking at the question of visibility. Okay, if the air is clean, you can see up to roughly about 120 miles, right? If there's stuff in the air, you don't get to see 120 miles. And you can determine to at least a fair degree what the concentration level of particulate matter is in the atmosphere by visibility alone. You can make a very reasonable estimate.
Okay? Yeah. You know, I appreciate the 7 miles thick, but it's the around that gets me. You know, this is a huge planet, so we have a 7 mile thick layer that covers hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square miles in surface area, if you will. So the surface 7 miles thick, crazy winds, again, devil's advocate and skeptical. It just seems it would take a tremendous volume to have any impact at all on that.
You know, I don't go by seams. I did a project to study that question. The paper is on the site, and everyone can examine whether or not they think that paper is reasonable or feasible. That's the best I can offer.
Fair enough.
Clifford, you might want to send that paper. Email it to Mark, and maybe you can put it up on the site so people can see it.
Well, it's on the site somewhere. We'll find it.
Okay. All right. Eric in Michigan, also on the wild card line. Hi, Eric. What's on your mind?
Hey,
hello?
George.
Hey.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
You can hear me okay, right?
We can.
Okay, very good. I have several extreme points. Let's see. Title 50 of the United States Code, Chapter 32, Section 1528. This was relayed to me by a local FBI agent. After a whole week of calling, I finally connected with one who said, yep, I can't talk to you about it, but go check out this particular statutory code site. And it states that they can experiment on a local populace if they provide a 30-day advance notice to the local ruling autocracy. Also, the elevation concern that Mark brought up. December 05, for a whole hour, I sat in a snowbank and viewed skyward. Jets about 5 minutes in separation. The vertical tail section had nozzles that were prominently displayed as allowing an effluent, emitting an effluent. Okay, and the engines were either on the wings or they were at the base of the vertical tail section, whereas these nozzles were up higher, and it was clear that the effluent was emitting from those nozzles. And I can guarantee you, being on the ground eyeballing this, that wasn't 38,000 feet. Now, relative to the conspirators and their family members, Whitley Strieber and others have revealed the fact that Kathy O'Brien, Transformation America, she was a CIA sex slave that was sold into the program by her or her dad.
Yeah, we had her as a guest.
Cheryl and Lynn Hersha, same thing. So the Mark says, well, hey, why wouldn't they be concerned about their own kids or their own family? Well, some of these people, or most of them, really don't care. Now, the EPA recently categorized CO2 as a dangerous effluent, right? Dangerous chemical. A particular chapter of the EPA, they have a website, and here it is, N for National, T for Treasury, E for Employee, U for Union, 280.org, NTEU280.org. And what these EPA scientists did is they reviewed the purportedly valid scientific data regarding fluoride. And what did they discover? It's fabricated fraud. Don't you think, based on that, Mark, where you have, parts per million of fluoride in your so-called municipal drinking water that your government says, hey, it's safe and it's great for drinking. You can bathe in it, no problem. Well, go to their website, NTEU280, and see what the EPA scientists at that chapter 280 have to say. Go to fluoridealert.org.
Fluoridealert.org. Good points. I'm going to let Mark answer. Thanks, Eric, for the call. Go ahead, Mark.
Right off the bat, Eric, you know, I appreciate that. I would need to see who the people behind the website you just mentioned really are, because anybody can create a .org website and claim to be EPA scientists. With regard to someone selling their daughter off into sex slavery, I'm just not quite sure how to respond to that. That person just should be shot, I think. And if that's what we've come to, then we're all screwed. And that's pretty much all I can say about that.
Clifford, anything to add to that caller's comment?
No, I don't.
Okay. International Line, Dave in Ontario. Hi, Dave.
Hi, George. Good to talk to you finally. I've got some information on low-level spraying in Hamilton, Ontario here, but I wanted to quickly touch base on how it is that you can't get information out if you want to try to blow the whistle. I've been trying to get stuff out for 15 years. In fact, I left messages on your machine last May, and I contacted Above Top Secret, who sent me an email, but I found it months later buried. Didn't see it originally, didn't come through, and it's a nightmare to try to get this stuff out.
Well, you have the floor.
Okay. What I've seen was the jets, looks like F-16 flying on a, not a grid pattern, but parallel, maybe every city block. It would be north of the escarpment here in Hamilton, and through increments, they would fly parallel to the street. And I used to flash my flashlight at them. I'd just catch them going over the apartment complex I lived in because you could hear them. They'd make a lot of noise. I could hear them flying by. And a couple times I flashed my light at them. And the third time the guy came in so low, and I'm talking these things are low. Like they're probably a 3-inch wingspan. I don't know how high that up would be, but they were that low that they looked like about 3-inch wingspan. And the third time he came through with a spotlight pointing down to the ground, and I saw this mist enveloping the plane. I didn't even think it was a plane at first. I was wondering what the heck it was. And then I could see it when he got close, it was a plane, and all this mist was around him. And I've also seen it where they fly depending on how much rain clouds are in the sky. It'd be every 5 minutes to every 20 minutes. They'd make these passes by, like city blocks apart, and I'd watch the clouds evaporate and a wind current start from the escarpment towards the lake. So I think they're using it, A, as weather modification, and the worst part is for crop contamination. There is so much mold they found in the food that comes into the city. It's this white mold that they talked about that they found in the bats that were dying in caves, and it probably explains where the honeybees are going to and butterflies and everything else. That's how bad it is.
Clifford, comments?
You know, on my side, I go by what I can see, what I can record, and what I can analyze, you know, and I know we have to make a lot of projections, or we try to make a lot of projections about specific methods, and, you know, the fact is specific details, let's say of dissemination, are simply not available. The evidence indicates multiple systems have been used or are considered. So specific details of actual method, and, you know, we get off in these discussions of, you know, things that cannot be affirmed or refuted in any way. How are you going to talk about the existence on a nozzle on a plane when we can't see it? We have to deal with the reality of the consequences and impact of what we see and what we can measure until you get a proper and direct line into examination at the source. And at this time, and for the last 12 years, there is no way that seems forthcoming.
Yeah, Dave has some interesting details there. And, Dave, you might want to send an email to Clifford and share further details on what you saw. He might get a chance to analyze it. But it's sort of like the UFO field. You know, people have very credible sighting incidents and very specific details about what they saw. But by the time an investigator can get there, the thing is gone. And while it's interesting and anecdotal, what do you do with it as an analyst? Mark, you're familiar with that, the influx of that kind of information.
Oh, yeah, big time. And I would like to say to the caller, please write this down, Mark, M-A-R-K, @thebethenetwork.com. Email me that stuff. You know, and the only other suggestion I could offer is get a video camera. You know, videotape that stuff. Give us something we can, you know, wrap our eyes and minds around, and we're with you.
I want to ask another question. We don't have time to go to the phones again, but maybe it's something that has to be answered after the break, but it's about the Ukraine. You guys have both seen the reports, maybe exaggerated out of the Ukraine, about some sort of a pandemic there. There are also isolated reports about planes being seen spraying a milky white substance. Clifford, any thoughts that there's a connection?
I have no access to information that anyone else doesn't have access to, and we know these reports exist, and people draw inferences and connections. But, again, if I don't have the information, what can I possibly say that
sure
would clarify that which beyond that which is circulated in the milieu?
Seems like we've seen some indications that those reports out of the Ukraine might have been exaggerated, that maybe it's covering up something else, some kind of a bioweapon accident or a release of chemicals of some sort. Mark, you know anything about it?
Only what's, you know, been put up on the site, and there's been a whole lot. You know, my short answer would be, if you're looking over here, they might be doing something over there.
George, if we have a second, I would like to make a comment.
And sure.
It's related to the very emphatic statement by the earlier guest that it is absolutely impossible to consider the fact that there is a global biological aspect to these operations. And
okay.
I would simply say that I think that statement is unusual, it's premature, and it is, I regard it as somewhat preemptive. In the sense that how could one make such a statement when we have not even begun to discuss the information and evidence that is available on a physical level?
Fair point. Clifford Carnicum and Mark Allen, stick around. We have a lot of people on the lines with questions for you. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for staying with us, everyone. Interesting conversation with Clifford Carnicum and Mark Allen, and earlier with William Thomas. We're going to the phones east of the Rockies, John in Michigan. Hi, John.
Hello, gentlemen, and I want to thank you for being so patient, because I can hear the frustration in your voice.
I'm not frustrated. I'm having fun.
Me too. I was just listening to it. It's wonderful. A point that I wanted to make was, well, first I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was a driver instructor safety supervisor in Los Angeles driving for Greyhound, and I got exposed to Gulf War illness in Oceanside, California, at Camp Pendleton. So I know about Gulf War illness. And listening to Art Bell and the Coast to Coast programs over the years, being retired on disability now, there's been plenty of this topic come out. And one time there was a circumstance that came up probably in a year and a half or so into the chemtrail story. There was a gentleman that was up in Washington State, I believe, and he had some tankers that were flying spraying over his property, low flights, let's say, probably 10,000 feet or less. And evidently one of the nozzles on the spray got clogged up or something, because a big glob of information that he sent to the CDC came back that it was something that they didn't recognize. They
a big glob, meaning a big glob of material that fell on his property or something?
Yes, it fell in his backyard, and it was foamy stuff. So he is an intelligent individual, and he was very careful and sent that information to them. And they said that they didn't recognize what it was. They said it was definitely a biological pathogen, but they didn't recognize what it was. That they assumed it was probably a military type, and that was the end of that conversation. I mean, no more information came out about that at all, period. It just disappeared in a dark room somewhere.
Clifford, what do you do with a story like that?
Well, you know, I consider it as an account. What I do is I consider it as an account. I basically make note of it and file it. And generally, in my work, I look for patterns and corroboration. I know that I think I'm aware of that particular story. It's quite interesting. It is an event. It is an account. I don't afford any special privilege to any single isolated event, but it certainly sets the stage, at least for raising some questions, even at that early level, about the unexplained existence of certain biological materials. I think that's fair to say.
I guess the ideal would be if John's friend who had this experience saved some of the sample. It didn't send it all to the CDC.
Well, I think that'd be helpful, sure. You know, if we have, you know, anytime I do things, if somebody sends me something, I tell them to keep most of it and just send me the minimum amount to accomplish the task. So you save it for the time. If somebody actually does step up and do their work properly, that we have it available.
Is John still there? John's gone. West of the Rockies, Bobby in Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Bobby.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. I find the chemtrail thing like probably the most disturbing obvious thing that's going on, actually. But I've seen this stuff for quite a while, and my dad was in the Air Force for 23 years, I believe. And it's definitely something that's not a contrail, that's for sure. I think I may have. I wanted to ask Clifford if he has any knowledge of the polymer strands attaining vertical velocity from exposure to sun rays or maybe even electrical charges. Because I believe I collected some one time, and it had this peculiarity of wanting to float vertically. I mean, later it broke down, and actually I think it got me sick when I breathed it in. Had it contained, but I think Mark, you're making Cliff a little frustrated. He's been studying this, and I don't know where you've been living or observing from, but it's been in the news in Northern California, and there's, you know, been a lot of rhetoric about it. I find it just disturbing and incredibly disturbing that there seems to be nothing we can do about it.
Well, I think Mark is asking the kinds of questions that that need to be asked, and that I would imagine that Clifford expects to hear. Cliff?
Know anything about the polymers floating by being stimulated electrically or by solar radiation?
I guess two things there very quickly. George, yes, absolutely correct. If we don't examine and ask questions about what it is we're trying to answer, how do we ever get those answers? So,
sure.
You know, in terms of, you know, any differential and vertical velocity, do I have any specific information on that? No, not at all. I've actually never recorded or had a direct observation of the material. I've had it sent to me. I've had the reports sent to me. I have no video of that in motion. What I have done is spent extensive time, studying the nature and chemistry and physical characteristics and biological characteristics of that material when I do have an appropriate sample. And that is what has been done, and that work becomes more and more complex, especially recently.
Mark, anything to add?
No, other than, you know, I just want to make it clear that there's hundreds of thousands of people. And Clifford, thank you for understanding my questions and why they're being asked. There are hundreds of thousands of people and millions of visitors who come to a website and they ask these questions. So, you know, I'm just trying to ask the questions that, as George astutely pointed out, probably need to be asked.
Thanks for the call, Bobby. First time caller, Myra in Kansas City. Hi, Myra.
Hi. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. I was just calling because it's kind of weird. I've never even thought about on another level of what I saw, but this was back, I can't tell you exactly what year, but in between 91 and 95, I lived in Minnesota going to college, and probably about every 3 months or so, I would drive home. And now you guys have made the single coolest thing I ever saw in Iowa odd. I had to pull over one night because I watched forever as I was driving south, and I was still north of Des Moines, but in the southwest sky, I could see like a crosshatch pattern for a long time. Well, then eventually, as I got a little bit closer, the sun began to set, and it absolutely looked like a gorgeous purple and orange plaid sky because of the lines were so exaggerated and so extreme that I pulled over and took several pictures of it, actually. And so it brings up two questions. One, in hindsight, as a normal person, you look at the sky and you see the contrails are generally, in my recollection at least, of a plane taking off. So they're growing and they're going upwards. So when I try to understand what could cause a crosshatch pattern like I saw, you would think then that you'd be seeing the planes coming in, which you usually don't see. And normal planes taking off or landing or going into or with the tailwind, you know, into the headwind or away from the wind. So it seems like it would just be a series of lines as opposed to a crosshatch. So that was one question I had was, you know, are there contrails when they're descending typically? But the other thing that was so strange, because this thing that I saw in the sky actually lasted, had to have been at least an hour that I watched it and then stopped and photographed it with the sunset behind it. Recently, within the last few months, I saw an article about Nebraska, because this is the other thing. I was watching this in the southwest sky, whereas the airport in Des Moines, in hindsight, would have been to my southeast. So it wasn't directly over the airport. But there's been a higher cancer ratio, I guess, in Iowa and Nebraska recently, and I was just wondering if you had any comments on either of those for me, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Clifford, is there a pattern of planes ascending or descending and releasing this stuff, or is it mostly way up there?
Well, you know, how would I say that? First thing I would do, in terms of, we won't have it tonight, but in terms of answering these questions, the first thing that I would do is one needs to make a division between three things. One, the first is contrails, the second is clouds, and the third are aerosols. And we would have to describe the physics and mechanics of each of those. They are not the same thing. And that is part of the problem that happens is there is a mixing of language, whether it's a deliberate obfuscation or I can't say that. But what I can say is it's necessary to make distinctions in terms of pure definitions and the physics of what it is we're speaking of before we can sensibly even address what it is we're talking about. That won't happen tonight, likely, but at least I can make the point. The second would be in terms of ascending or descending. I would say, You know, I have photographs where I've looked at this, and I remember an initial impression that I had somewhat of the same initial impression that, hey, that looks like it's ascending or descending. All I can say, that made no sense from a physical standpoint, and, you know, I would conclude that as simply an optical illusion where you see something. You know, the Earth curves. It's a curvature, right? So if something can be seen a long distance, it will begin to, particularly if an operation, let's say, is originating from a particular location, you have multiple aircraft, those trails will converge or originate from that location, and because of the curvature of the Earth, you're going to have a convergence of those lines, and that can appear to be an ascending or a descending quality to it. I certainly would not expect that in terms of the physics or chemistry of contrail formation, of which I also have worked on extensively over the years, and those reports are also available for people to review. In terms of cancer in Nebraska, I have no specific information regarding that. I think at this stage we can only begin to open up the question of health effects, and unless you have the proper studies done, how would you begin to know what the direct connections are? The best we can do is analyze the physical materials and the biologicals that are directly accessible to us.
It's sort of a natural thing for people to make that leap. You know, they see this strange phenomenon in the sky. They learn later about cancer rates. They read stuff on the internet, and they try to put two and two together, whether they add up to four or not, because we are by nature inquisitive.
Absolutely. It's absolutely. All I can say is I try to be fair and honest in my work the best that I can be.
And, Mark, you would argue that there's not necessarily a causation or a link between something you see in the sky and cancer rates going up?
Well, I mean, there's as Clifford just said, there's been no evidence of that. And I would hope that somebody's studying it, you know, with all the pollution stuff and the global warming activists that are out there and the money being funded to them. I would hope someone is studying this stuff. And I'm sure they are. We could certainly look into that. But as far as crosshatches go, 43,000 flights across America on a Saturday, you're going to get crosshatch. I mean, regional jets cross over rural areas now where they never did before. I live in Comanche, Oklahoma. You don't get much more rural than where I'm at. And I see crosshatch contrails in the sky above me.
And probably half of those are planes that you've flown on or are getting ready to fly on. Thanks for the call, Myra. A wildcard line, Scott in California. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, hi, guys. Just a real quick one. I hate to sort of be so obvious, but I've been listening. It's been totally fascinating and very informative. So thank you guys for doing that. But the one question I have to ask is why? What would be the motive behind the reason for all this effort and energy on the part of whomever it is that's conducting this, what could possibly be their ultimate agenda?
Scott, we've already covered that, but let me rephrase your question in a way that maybe put a new angle on it. I mean, Clifford, you know, we've looked at a lot of dark possible motives for this, all kinds of things, New World Order, population control, whatever. There could be very good motives for this. I mean, altruistic motives, I guess, even if they're misdirected.
I suppose that's possible. I suppose that's possible. If something is altruistic and for our benefit and betterment, I personally think it should be a privilege for us to know about it.
And, yeah, that they should come clean about it.
Yeah, if something's good for us, I think that would be a great thing to talk about.
Mark, anything to add to that?
You know, it's a very good question. You know, why we're building up trillions of dollars of debt, and we have been for years. Really, what is the point behind it? If it's population control, as I said earlier, you're risking your own family. So that's a great question. And the nefarious deeds aspect of it, again, you've got very little control over who you are perpetrating the nefarious deeds upon. So,
thanks for the call, Scott. Wildcard Jerry in Connecticut. Good morning, Jerry.
Hey, hello. How's it going?
Okay.
I got very little time. I just wanted to ask one question. Do you think the chemtrails are probably related to a future catastrophe or around 2011 or 2012 to prevent some kind of major weather changes in the future?
Clifford, maybe you tackle that
along with the HARP technology or something?
My answer to that is I have absolutely no idea. That's not meant in a flippant sense. It's just meant it's true. I think generations have had a level of intrigue with the 2012 scenario and prophecies, but obviously there's been generations of people trying to decipher that encoding without any, let's say, defined results. And I'm no different than anybody else as far as access to that information. Well, that's all I can say about that. And it doesn't mean I deny any potential connection or possibility, but I don't have access to that information because I can't predict the future.
Mark, you must get 2012 angles and allegations in almost everything, every topic that's listed on your site at this point, don't you?
We definitely do. And one of the aspects of the caller's question that has really intrigued me about the chemtrails specifically is there is so much public information out there. The governments have all admitted to it. The NOAA, the Air Force, everybody's admitted, yes, we have played with spraying aerosols in the sky for weather manipulation. Typically, and obviously, they claim to help mankind. Now, with regard to 2012, that's a fascinating question that, as Clifford said, I have to say, I have no clue if they're connected or not, but with all the craziness going on about 2012, and it is right around the corner, I guess we're going to have to wait and see.
Thank you. Thanks to all of our callers. Clifford, I really appreciate you coming on and taking the direct questions in a good spirit of trying to get to the bottom of it. In a quick capsule, can you tell us what you need as a researcher to nail this down?
Well, my goodness, we need the active and proper participation of any authority or agency that is, let's say, protecting the welfare of the general public. Okay, that's number one. Number two, we need very specific answers to very specific questions. They're not vague. They're very specific questions, particularly on the biological side right now. We need participation. We need involvement by the citizens of the planet, not just this country, to recognize that no one owns the atmosphere, no one owns the water, no one owns the ground. We are privileged as citizens of this planet to have the benefit of life, and we should, cherish and safeguard that privilege by taking care of our home and our planet. That's what we need to do.
Clifford Carnicum, thanks for joining us. Mark Allen, anything to add?
Yeah, I would like to throw out there to everyone, including Clifford and William, who left us earlier, that, you know, AboveTopSecret.com truly is your best friend if you've got something. And that's all we ever ask. Bring us something, and we will stand behind you, and we will make sure it gets out there. And if there's a chance to, you know, round up the population of the planet, get them, you know, behind something and demand the answers, we're there for you.
Mark Allen of Above Top Secret, thanks very much. Clifford Carnicum and earlier William Thomas, it was an interesting conversation. I'll be back next Sunday night. Merry Christmas, everyone. Hope you have a good week. Bye.